Red St. Germains. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Today is a lovely and oh so amazing Friday evening. And we are talking. The number in studio is 083-288-401. That is the number in studio. In case you would like to join us, in case you would like to sit a while with us, in case you want to know what we're talking about or you want to participate in what we are talking about, you are more than welcome. So today I got a comment of I'm boring now. That one I've been used to that one, and I've been waiting for it to come because, you know, I'm a boring person, you know, I'm a very boring auntie. So I got it from one of my, I would say my nieces, man, my youngins, right? That she's like, oh no, you're very boring now. Now that you don't drink. But I think that it's weird because I've not been drinking for a very long time. And it's only now that she's seeing my boringness. And I've always wondered, right? How would you know if you have changed? How would you know if you have, reached that pinnacle of change and reached that climax of change and you are finally in the domain that you would like to be in? Because many of us walk the path of wanting to change and wanting to be better and wanting to do better. But then it seems as though we start practicing the practices and we start doing what we need to do, but we don't really know when we have hit it. So how will we know if we have changed or if we have not changed? That is the point of our conversation. That is our conversation. That is what we're talking about. And just to sprinkle it up, right? Sometimes in relationships, the argument is that you have changed. And sometimes in relationships, our partners change for the worst or for the better. And this change in itself is not always seen by the person that is changing and is not always seen by the person that, intentionally wants to change. But sometimes it is noticeable by those that look. And also sometimes it's noticeable by you that wants to actually change. It's like keeping track of progress. So we are talking about the change in a good way and not the bad way. The bad way would be like our Tuesday story. Our Monday story, we had the conversation around giving the nice guy a chance. And then we reached the part where they wanted now to get married because they've been together for 2 years. And initially the girl, madame, she settled, you know, she decided to give this nice guy an opportunity to be her man, an opportunity to be the leading man in her life, the only man in her life. And, She learned how to love him and she learned how to be with him, and she learned, you know, because it wasn't spontaneous. It wasn't, butterflies. It wasn't roses and rose petals. It wasn't, long nights on the beach. It wasn't that. It was really just an intentional choice that she made, like a conscious decision that she made, that this is the person that I'm going to be with. This is the person that I'm going to love. This is the person that is befitting for me in this phase in my life, or in this stage in my life, because phases fade out, but it's a stage in her life. And the stages after that would require a person of his nature to be in her life. And that's why she intentionally chose to be with this particular gentleman. This particular gentleman was not the ordinary guy that she would date or she would see. It wasn't the ordinary guy that she would even be attracted to or interested in, but she chose that. And also our conversation also drove through the avenues of, do men settle as well? And my answer is absolutely. I believe that each and every one of us do settle. But in contemporary times, the issue with our decisions is that every Tom, Dick and Harry has an opinion about what we are doing and how we are living our lives. So they label it. You might be thinking that this is a perfect match for me. This is somebody that can carry me throughout life and I can carry them throughout life. They have the qualities that I would like, and it's not necessarily that they would fit into my drinking crowd. It's not necessarily that they would fit into my chess crowd, but they would be a perfect match for me. The problem is that the onlooker, the pavement special, the one that's standing on the sidewalk, looks at you and labels it. And this label is they don't look good together, they don't fit well together, or ye sheka, or whatever they choose to label it as. Or in the 21st century, we call it settling. You are settling for less. You are settling for less than you deserve, because apparently you are such a diamond, and apparently the world loves you so much, and apparently you're such a catch, right, that you don't deserve to be with a person that is beneath you and not of your caliber. But the question would also stem from, what do you categorize as my caliber, and where is this person that you would like me to be with that is of my caliber? Because we all have an opinion about other people's relationships, but we don't have a replacement. And even if we do have a replacement for the person that we want whoever to be with, can they fit the bill? Can they walk the walk? Can they talk the talk? Can they be as essential, as sensual, as potent, as fulfilling as the partner that they have? So my theory is that, well, men do settle for less, in our opinion, because we say less is calm, and less is what, and less is what. But we would now have to go to the definition of what less is, because if we say you are settling means that you are not absolutely happy, you're not absolutely achieved, you're not absolutely fulfilled with this decision that you're making. You're just taking it, it's like you're taking third place, basically, or you're taking fourth place. You're taking the medallion for participation, not for winning, but for participation. So that's why we'd say, oh girl, don't settle. The sky is your limit. No, nana, the sky is not your limit. This is exactly where you're supposed to be. But many of us have these unrealistic expectations of the world and others, and especially when it comes to others, we have this whole imagination that runs wild, that actually is none of our business. We're not supposed to be so invested in who somebody is dating and who somebody wants to marry and who somebody wants to grow old with. We're not supposed to be that invested in other people's lives, because we like to escape our own lives to go and meddle in other people's lives. So you are apparently settling when you are looking for different qualities that are not necessarily physical features, that are not necessarily educational features, or financial features, or whatever kind of features they think that you should have. So some people look at you and they're like, oh my goodness, Tuafeni, you are such an adorable person, you are learned, you are what, you deserve somebody on your level. And the problem is that you, no matter how achieved you are, no matter how what you are, You don't need a timid woman. You can't be with a timid woman, because you are naturally a pushover, for example. And you are a pushover, so you need somebody that's held strong and held bent, and also somebody that's motivated and ambitious. So now you find Selma, and Selma is very ambitious. She might not have the degree, she might not be a looker the way your exes are, she might not be achieved, she might not be all these other things, all these superficial things that are out there, but she has the one quality to drive you home, like in terms of, like, it's a home run state with this particular lady. And the world is looking at you like, this is not the one we expected you to have. But then, yeah, it's not your life, so what's your problem? Why are you so invested? So but then this person builds your life. This person builds your life, helps you build your life. This person has the capability of telling you no. This person has the ability to tell you that this is a bad decision and you should do it like this and you should do it like this. Whereas you go and date Wilhelmine with her degrees and her what, and she's just a yes sir, no sir, no ma'am, yes sir, no ma'am. She's a yes man, and you don't want that. So somebody would say that you are settling in that case. You are settling. And it's according to their standards. It's really honestly according to their standards. Every time somebody says that it's settling, it is really according to their standards. Because at the end of the day, right, we can have unrealistic expectations of other people. We are allowed to, because at the end of the day, it's our lives. It's our lives, and this is what we want. We have unrealistic expectations of other people. But there are some expectations that you just can't fold on. Your expectations is that this person is going to be with you, this person is going to be loving, this person is going to be caring, this person is going to be what. But then sometimes loving and caring comes in a packaged as strict package. So the package is strict, but the package is loving. The package is caring. The package is coming through. The package is angry, but the package is still cooking. The package is angry, but the package is still coming through. The package is angry, but the package, like, because this is what you get. And it leads me now to the ultimate question around this topic of, what are you looking for? If you are looking for stability, if you're looking for a home, then you have to have certain things that you cannot miss within your home setting. And I know that there are other bigger things that might creep up, but then if you have the main character in your story, if you have the main, the ensemble of your whole entire story, then everything else is something that you can either live with or you can discuss, and maybe, just maybe, changes can be made. So how will you know if you have made the necessary changes? You will know you have changed by noticing consistent shifts in your thoughts, feelings, actions, and reactions over time. So we have to be specific about what are we changing about so that we can see most now, which are the consistency. So if you say that I'm not going to be milking cows anymore, then you'll see the consistency of not milking cows. You'll see the consistency of not thinking about milking cows. You'll see the consistency about not feeling some type of way about milking cows. You'll see the fact in, you'll notice it in action also, which are like everything that you do goes against milking cows and your reactions towards milking cows. That's how you will know that you have changed. For example, because all of us are preaching, let's change, right? Especially me, Queen Mother of the Tribe. I preach change, 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 man, change. You know, I preach change because I think that, we are all capable of changing the bad things that we don't like about ourselves. And the bad things that we don't like about ourselves, right? That is wonderful to change. But what happens when you have bad traits and bad characteristics that you don't know about and nobody is telling you? And even when it is said, right, it is not said in a conducive manner for you to actually hear what is being said. It is being said to you in the most awful way possible. And your heart is racing and you are uncomfortable and you are being embarrassed. You are in the midst of people and you are being told about how selfish and greedy you are and how condescending and patronizing you are. Now, even if you wanted to change, right, would you listen to somebody basically insulting you in front of others and take their advice? And what would your response be? Would your response be like, yeah, I'm absolutely patronizing. Thank you so much for telling me in the midst of everybody here that I'm patronizing, a word that I don't even really think I know how to define it, and I don't really know if I can even spell it, but thank you for calling me that word. I will take it up with the thought police and I will work on changing it. Nobody says that. Nobody says that because we are human beings, right? So we want positive change. So anyways, leading back, because you guys must keep up tonight. Nah? I'm on a roll. I drank cool drink. You guys must keep up. Oh, we're on a roll. So now what happened was these two were together. Now you guys have the backstory that he's not a catch. He's not what, but he is everything else that she really honestly needs, and also one of the things that he definitely is for her and she is for him, right, is that he grounds her. He grounds her. He he is that safe space. He's that stability. He's that voice of reason that she has been yearning for the most part of her life, because, she wanted different, and she definitely got it. And then for him, she is the plan maker. The plan maker is somebody that paves the way where there is no way. Somebody that makes things happen for you. So we also talked about the fact that he was afraid to apply for a promotion and for a new position, and she went ahead and did it, you know, waymaker. She went ahead and did it, and then he got the promotion, he got more money, he got a job, he got an extra job. It was nicer. You know, so they do complement each other. So what had happened with these two is that 2 years down the line, they are now officially talking about marriage, and they're talking about a forever together, because they are smitten. They love each other, and it's not that kind of weird love. You know, the weird love that makes you jump through hula hoops and sneak out at night, and not that kind of love. It was the ordinary kind of love where we are really just talking about the electricity. How much electricity is there? We're talking about the water bill. We're talking about Vurman Brock. We're talking about what we plan to do with the house, what we plan to do with this, and we are, it's anticlimactic. But I think that when you've had so much climax in your life, you reach a point where you don't want drama anymore. You don't want catastrophe anymore. You don't want a papa way anymore. You just want something nice, something quiet, something calm, something where we can definitely estimate predictability. Predictability is everything. And we say that predictability is good, because even within our childhoods, right, it is nice to see that you have a parent that is predictable. A parent that is predictable is like a foundation. It's like a foundation of some sort, because you know that your parent is always going to be like this. Your parent is always going to be in a mood like this. Your parent is always going to be, your parent is not going to come back and today they are hurricane, tomorrow they are tsunami, tomorrow they are roses and dandelions, and then the day after that there's something different. Predictability is good within children, because it teaches you how to be calm. It teaches you how to depend on people, and to trust people, and to allow yourself to be vulnerable with other people. So that's what predictability within a parent sets for their children. Now, if you're an unpredictable parent, right, where children can't place where you are going, what mood you are going to be in, it means that your children are always going to be upbeat and on their feet. And you might think that it's nice now, up until they become the unpredictable parents, and your grandchildren are suffering at the hands of your child because you made your child suffer at your hand. And that's why we have to learn how to break certain cycles. You can't be in a household where you were watching violence every day, and then now you want to be a perpetrator. You can't do that. You have to break certain generational cycles, you know, where your children can just grow up in a violent free home, or your children can grow up in a predictable home. Because if you come back home and your mother is there and you are surprised, right? Not because it's not 5 o'clock, but you are surprised that she's there, because some days she's there, some days she's not there. Some days she's gone, some days she's what, and she doesn't notify, right? Then that also causes an instability. If you want to test if you are predictable or not, right? See the way your children receive you when you get back. If your children have things to say to you when you get back from work, right? You are a predictable parent. And that's good, because they are also going to be, they are going to be predictable parents as well. They are going to keep up the habit of what you've started, because they see you as Superman. They see you as Superwoman. They see it as correct. You understand? So if you are predictable, your children will so often embrace you, and they would be happy to be in your company. Now, if you're an unpredictable parent, they don't know in which mood you are in today. They don't know if you are willing to have a conversation. They don't know if they should bring their school paper. And sometimes you are being called over one of the telltale signs is also you're being called over to school because there are many papers that this child just never brings forward. There is the tax show paper, there is the casual paper. Imagine this, your child is the only child that wears, right, school uniform on casual day every single day. Every single time that they wear casual, your child wears school uniform. Now, you are wondering why. When you drop them off, you're wondering why. And they got the paper, but your child couldn't bring that paper to you. So what does that say? What does that say? I don't know which mood you're going to be in today. So I don't know if I should give you this paper or not. So I'm just going to not give you this paper so that I can just stay out of your sight so that you don't have to say anything. And that's basically it. And we don't want to be parents like that. We want to be better. We want to somewhere find our children not on the couch of a psychiatrist. And we are not the problem. I don't want to be the problem. Personally, for me, that's my biggest fear. My biggest fear is to be the problem. My biggest fear is for my child to be sitting in a doctor's office saying that, yeah, my childhood was bad because my mom, And the worst part about this is that sometimes, they call us in. And then they say that we should do group counseling. Now in group counseling, your child feels like a superhero when, right, the psychiatrist is there. So your child, it's more like your child throws you under the bus. Literally, it's like reporting you to the principal at the psychiatrist or at the psychologist. Your child throws you under the truck. I remember there was a time where, I had therapy. So I've always been in therapy. I've been one of those kids that have been in therapy for a while. I've had like one doctor, and then now and then I go to other doctors, but then I've got one doctor that specifically, he's got that black psychology. He doesn't have that come back again. He's really one of those people that has assisted me in so many ways. You know, he just tells you, okay, so you were telling me a story and here you said this. So let's talk about why you said this. And then you explain why you said it. And then in your explanation, you would then also go on to say that could it be that this is maybe the reason that what did you think about it? Or it's like, yeah. And then it's, and then I have to see them like again next year if something major happens in my life. And every time he sees me, he says, ah, Elizabeth, you only come when the problem is bigger than you. So what's wrong? So he always says that, ah, Elizabeth, you only come when the problem is bigger than you. So what's wrong? So I don't, so there was a time that I had so many issues and so much bottled up anger and stuff. So we had to have a group session. Group counseling where all my family members had to participate. So it was my stepdad, it was my mom, and it was my older brother. And we had a session. So, in the session, my mom was hella defensive. My dad, like, you know, when I talk about my stepdad, he was an ideal dad. He was an ideal man. You know, he had his flaws, but he was an ideal man. My dad chose to listen. My dad chose to listen and chose to understand. His wife, on the other hand, felt completely ambushed. Like, yeah, you are telling people our secrets. I'm like, this is a doctor that's supposed to be helping me. You cannot be telling me that it's not even our secrets. It's your own secrets. So at the end of the day, this is what we're talking about when we're talking about your children and predictability. And sometimes in a relationship, you want predictability also. And predictability is good to some degree. It's good to some degree when you are trying to build a home and trying to build a forever with this person. So predictability, yay, 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 yay.
Heineken's iconic balanced taste that gives you that refreshing first only made possible by Heineken's 5-star credentials. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHB on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Do you have a question you want answered on air? Have a quick comment you want to share with the presenter? Eagle FM's SMS line is now open. Send your questions and thoughts to 1040. That's 1040 for only $1.50.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM in any of its staff. Ngeno wapumbwa Eva Tero ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe utete opoye ekukulile oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune udo otukwetira o special ngetashia kengeshefa omarudi kayo loka opone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijabo ili nawa ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
So, we are talking about changes and how we will know that we eventually changed, or we have changed for the better, or changed for the worst. Okay, so, these two are in that, you know, they're in that, let's get together, let's be calm, let's be, you know, grown up. They're in that grown folk love, right? And with their grown folk love, they have now started to reminisce or try and build around the life that they are having. And trying to build around the life that they're having means that they have to see the tomorrow, right? And you know now Mans is cool most now. Hey, he's cool. He's really just a nice guy that's cool like other guys. And he used to be a nerd. You know, and she made him who he is now, and he's now cool, and he's likable, and he's yum yum. The problem is that Oshimashoe, that you picked up on the street, and then you decided to take home, and she decided to polish it. Now everybody wants it. Now he's getting DMs because he's most now not driving his Tanki Botswana anymore because his girlfriend decided that, no, you make enough money for a Merc then, eh? Why are you not buying a Merc? Why? Why are you not in the Merc industry? You have enough money for a Merc. Why are you not Mercing it? And she decided that I'm not doing this. Not unless you got a Merc, and he got a Merc. And now everybody's starting to notice us. And he's also not wearing his orthopedic shoes anymore. He's wearing the cool shoes that, girlfriend suggested. And he's also not wearing, you know, his three button what. He's starting to look sharp, okay? He's starting to look exactly the way we anticipated him. Anticipated him, and it's hectic, you know. And in this, so So as he starts to change, as he starts to become a little bit more attractive, a little bit more white, a little bit more white, he starts to you know, entertaining other women, because right now he's getting a lot of attention, and that attention is the same attention that is giving him most now that boost. So the question is, was he always like this, or is this something that he picked up with the newfound confidence? And that is now the problem, because she feels like, I made you who you are. I made you who you are, and now you want to turn around and play me like this. Why you want to play me like this? Why you want to play me like this? And he's like, no, I'm not playing you. You are just very clingy. You are just very white. You are just very white. Now all of a sudden he has a problem with her, but her argument is that I made you who you are. And if it wasn't for me, you wouldn't be this cool and you wouldn't be this attractive. But let's talk about change. And first of all, change is terrifying. And change is bad. It's good. It's in the middle. But before that, right? Ladies and gentlemen, today is Friday, and you know how we do on Fridays. We always have somebody that is going to say something about something. So you as a young leader, what do you know about change?
Several years ago, I was on a flight and this gentleman sits down next to me and strikes up the typical airplane small talk. So he says, "What do you do?" And I said, "I study and teach leadership." And without pause and dead serious, he goes, "Okay, so like trust falls and stuff." And I'm like, "What?" Because the part of me that had just spent about 7 years in grad school wanted to swear to this man, mostly to myself, that I didn't just spend that much of my life learning how to do trust falls. But the other part of me knew that this was a 4-hour flight and I'm in a window seat. I have no idea how long I'm going to be committed to this conversation. So I just said, "Yeah, it's basically trust falls." As you can imagine, leadership development isn't exactly about doing trust falls, but it is about understanding what it takes to walk with people into the unknown and try to build a better world. So today I want to talk to you about one idea that's at the heart of the work that I do, and that's leading through change. Now, what if I asked you, what changes have you experienced in the last 2 years? It's an impossible question. Wear a mask, don't wear a mask, work from home, come back to work, open the schools, close the schools, make banana bread, make sourdough. I mean, it hasn't stopped. It's all we've been doing. And we are tired. Psychologists call this change fatigue. It's where a lot of change is happening all at once, and so we get burned out and apathetic and frustrated. But change is always going to be a constant in our lives. And in fact, it's necessary for our progress in society and necessary for our evolution as human beings. So imagine the changes you've experienced in the last couple of years. And I'd like for you to raise your hand if you think that the leaders you saw did a fantastic job leading change. Okay, so maybe two of you. This is good. This is job security for me. But this is the reality. Good leadership is the exception. It's not the norm. But good leadership makes all the difference in how engaged and committed and hopeful we are as we walk into the future. Now, in my work, I often talk to leaders and I say, "What's the most difficult part about leading change?" And always they tell me it's the people, because people resist change. And they tell me about their attempts to start a new business or launch a new project or maybe new policies, new innovations. And they'll say it's so frustrating because people won't jump on board, or they drag their feet, or maybe just flat out oppose their efforts. Or they'll say, you know, it's confusing because I talk to people and they say they're committed, they say they're with me, but then come to find out, they've resorted back to their old habits and old behaviors and nothing changes. And then as leaders get more frustrated with the resistance that they're experiencing, they come to meet force with force. The very popular leadership technique that I call, because I said so. It's where leaders say, do it, because I said so. Parents, you might also know this one. But as you can guess, this doesn't work, at least not in the long term. You might get compliance, but you'll rarely ever get true commitment. And at this point, the leader has exhausted their ability to inspire people's hearts and minds and influence them in that way. And so now they're relying on the authority of their position to make people change. And it's a relational dynamic that leaders and their people find themselves in time and time again. Why? We make one crucial mistake right from the start. We don't get curious about the true cause of resistance. What is underneath change that people actually resist? I came across an answer to this question in one of my very first leadership books that I read, a book by Ron Heifetz and Marty Linsky. And they said that people don't resist change, they resist loss. This completely altered the way that I thought about change. It's not the change that we resist itself. It's what we stand to lose if the change actually happens. And leaders spend so much of our time thinking about what we want people to do that we forget about what we're asking people to give up. Now, there's some classic research by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky that found that the pain of losing something is twice as powerful than the pleasure of gaining something else. So even if the future is looking pretty good, the fear of loss causes us to keep this white-knuckle grip on the status quo. Now, loss can encompass many things across the course of our life. People, places, things, future plans. But there are several core types of loss that are particularly painful in social environments, like ones where leadership is happening. And I want to explore five of those with you today. So first, safety. The most basic. Will this change jeopardize my sense of safety? On a neurobiological level, we all need to feel safe physically and psychologically. And we get these things, we get this predictability in our life from things like stable jobs and reliable finances and healthy relationships. Or maybe you've got some rituals and routines that you've set up for yourself. And the more predictability equals the more safety. So when something comes along that makes your life all of a sudden unpredictable, it equals danger. And so we push back, we grasp for certainty because we're looking for safety. Two, freedom. Now, just as we want to feel safe and secure and grounded, we also need to feel free. Fundamentally, we want to say in how our life unfolds, how we get from A to B and the actions we take. Now, think about this dilemma that so much of our workforce is facing right now. 60 million people could do their jobs completely from home. But Gallup just found that 90% would prefer a partial or remote work option. So if employers came back tomorrow and said, we need everybody in the office, butts in seats, 8 to 5, Monday through Friday, expect resistance. Because this decision constrains the autonomy that people have come to value. Three, status. Will this change cost me my sense of status among my people? Social hierarchies govern our relationships as human beings, whether they're formal hierarchies or not. And the higher the status, the more respect, the more significance, the more power and influence you have. And once you have it, it's hard to let it go. which reminds me of an organization I worked with, and they were trying to implement this new technology that really changed the way they work together. And their people had to learn a lot of new things, and after several months, it wasn't very successful, it wasn't sticking, so I started to ask some questions, and I met Linda. And Linda told me, listen, I have been great at my job for 20 years. For 20 years, people come to me when they have questions, and now all of a sudden they're trying to get me to learn all these new things, and I'm not sure that I can or that I even want to, and I feel like people don't respect what I have to offer anymore. And I get it. I get it, because I imagine if we felt like Linda, if we were in a position where we had spent 2 decades building a reputation, and all of a sudden that was going away with some change in our environment, we'd probably push back too. 4, belonging. Just as much as we want to stand out, we also want to belong. One of my clients, Sarah, she had just gotten a promotion, and she told me it was bittersweet, and I'm like, I don't understand, because promotions are good. And she said, you know, I've been at this job for years, and for years I've been peers with these people. They've been my friends, they've come to my wedding, and now all of a sudden I'm their boss. And it's like our relationship changed overnight. It feels distant, it feels strained. And I get it. This promotion gave her a sense of significance and status, but it also, she worried that it cost her belonging in a group that she really come to know and love. And for me, Sarah's story also reminds us of this paradox of change, that we can experience the same event and feel both joy and sadness. Joy for what we're gaining, but sadness for what we have to give up. And finally, 5, fairness. If you have a sibling, you know about fairness. 1 year for Christmas, my dad just got my sister and I the same exact gifts. He just got 2 of everything, completely identical, down to the print of our shirts. Most peaceful Christmas we've ever had. But when you encounter fairness out in the world, and decisions are made that put fairness at stake, like, for instance, decisions, actions that might challenge the right to marry who we love, or decisions that might exacerbate pay inequity, expect resistance. Now, as it turns out, there's a common thread among all of these core needs. The reason that they are so important to us and are so deeply painful to lose is because when we're asked to give them up, we have to question core parts of our identity. Who we think we are. Who am I without this job or title or person? What does it mean about me and my people if we keep getting the raw end of the deal? Will I recognize myself if I don't see myself as competent, or if people don't respect me? We cling so tightly to our identities, and so if change requires that we have to give up a part of ourselves, it feels like the ground is falling out from underneath us. And so how do we find our footing? There was a study done by Merlin Venus, a Dutch professor, and his colleagues, and it looked at 2 groups of students. And both groups of students were experiencing very disruptive changes in their business school, and they both got these messages about what the purpose for the change was, what they should expect, what were some of the potential setbacks, and what were all the future benefits. But the second group got 1 additional message. And this message said that despite these changes, the core aspects of our program, teamwork, professionalism, fairness, those will not change. The students in that second group were 4 times more likely to accept the change and adjust their behavior. So what does this mean? It means that people are more open to change when they know what will stay the same. So the vision of a bright new future, that's only one half of the equation. We also need to know what will continue. And we can bring that forward when we highlight the aspects of ourselves, of our identity that will endure. So leaders must not act only as champions of change, but as anchors of stability and stewards of identity. Now you might be thinking, listen, I am just trying to get my people to use a new technology or get used to working with new team members, and you're telling me that someone is having a full-blown existential crisis down the hall. No, it might not be that dramatic. But don't underestimate the power that the threat of these losses has on our heart and minds and on shaping our behaviors. So, when change is happening and loss is on the horizon, how do we lead ourselves and others through it? Well, first, we have to consider the wisdom in resistance. Resistance can teach us if we let it. It can teach us what's important to ourselves and to others, and it can also teach us where we might have missed the mark, where perhaps our plans for change have caused harm, and so we need to go back and rethink our approach. But sometimes change is inevitable or it's necessary, and that means that loss is the price we pay for it, and also sometimes a necessary one. So we have to name the losses that others are facing and that we're facing. Ignoring or dismissing these losses, either others or our own, only breeds resentment and anger. But acknowledging these losses is an exercise in telling the truth. It's an exercise in giving permission to grieve what's gone. It's an exercise in saying, I see you. And it puts us on the path toward acceptance. And then shine a light on what stays the same. Leading change is a conversation about reimagining our future, yes, but it's also a conversation about remembering ourselves at the same time. By highlighting the parts of our identity that will endure, we give ourselves this anchor of stability as we navigate the unknown. And then finally, we can turn towards possibility, because when we know who we are and feel grounded in who we are, then we're free to dream about who we can become. So I'll leave you with this story about a time of change that I experienced in my life and some of the most simple yet extraordinary moments of leadership as well. Years ago, I applied for this job in the leadership studies department, and this was the job to me. It was the dream job. And it was the job that many of my mentors had had before me. I would be in the classroom with students doing what I loved. And so it was way more than a paycheck. It was a step toward who I wanted to become. And it also so happened that my mentor at the time was hiring for the job. So I was thinking, I got a pretty good shot. So after about a week, I hadn't heard from her. And so I email her and check in. And she just responds back, let's go for a walk. I'm like, you might as well have just texted me, we need to talk, or something equally as brutal, right? So I go, and it was a beautiful day outside, and we sit on this table. And I just kind of knew. I said, I didn't get it, did I? And she just calmly shook her head, and she said, no. And I could just feel the resistance in my body not wanting to accept the truth of this outcome. Because in an instant, the picture I had of my future for the next 3 years just vanished. But what she said next made all the difference in how I was able to meet this moment. She said, I know this role was really important to you because it meant getting to do work that you love and because some important people to you held this role before. But you can still do what you love anywhere else out in the world. And just her acknowledging what that meant for me, what that loss meant for me, it allowed me to really face it in myself, right? And to face that this was the reality. And I could feel the tightness in my body start to loosen a little bit. And then she said something I'll never forget. She said, "It's up to you how you want to take this. But I hope you take this in a way I think your spirit can." And I just let that sink in for a moment. "I hope you take this in a way I think your spirit can." And for me, it was like she was holding up a mirror to me, reminding me that I was resilient and determined and capable, and I love this work. And when I was able to come back home to that truth within myself, then I was able to feel grounded enough to accept the reality and then also consider the possibilities for my future. We've all experienced so much change and loss in the last couple of years, and it's going to be the same as we walk forward into our lives. So my hope is that the next time that change happens, we take the opportunity to practice leadership, whether that leadership is in your team or your community or your family, that we listen for the wisdom and resistance, that we meet the losses with empathy and anchor in the parts of ourselves that are steady and unwavering and let the rest go. And then it might be possible to write a new story of the future together. Thank you.
Yes, my beloveds, we are talking about change. We're talking about how will you know if you have changed? And, you know, we're just taking it from a change perspective. So, ladies and gentlemen, how do we embrace change then? Please keep in mind that the clips that we play here on our Fridays, on our Friday shows, we as Eagle Media House do not claim ownership of them. We do not say that they are ours. We just say that they have something to say, and we are sharing it.
Someone gets up at a TED talk and says, "Behold, we don't have to do it like this. I've got a better idea. There's another way. There's another technology. There's a new way of seeing the world." And then you guys go, "Wow, that's fantastic. We'll go out and create change." And you can't wait to go to your workplace or go back to the people that you live with and say, "Rejoice, my people. There is a better way. It doesn't have to be this way." And you're expecting the whole world to go, "Fantastic, it's going to change." And this is what you hit. You go, "Come on, we could do this. We could totally do this." And they go, "No. You know what? Because we've done it before, or now's not a good time, or we haven't got the money, or it's been done, it's never been done. That's not the way we do things around here. It's not part of the charter. It's traditional. It's complicated. It's political." Do you recognize any of these? And of course, they're all different ways of saying this. They're all just different ways of saying it's not going to happen. So what I've been doing, I work in the innovation space. I'm interested in this wall and how do we get past this wall? How do we take our passion and our ideas and actually make them happen? So I've been trying to figure out what this wall is made of and how do we get past it? Or if we can't get past it, go under it, go around it, or just smash through it. The first thing you need to know, these aren't real reasons. These aren't real reasons. And the reason that becomes pretty clear because they're so easy to refute. If they say, for example, "It's always been like this," what does that mean? It means the problem is older than you think it is. It's not an argument for not changing it now. It's a reason why we should have changed it 20 years ago. And when they say it's the same everywhere, what they're really saying is the problem is broader and wider than you think. That's not an argument for not fixing it here. It's an argument for fixing it everywhere. When they say, for example, "It's not in the budget," it means we've spent the money in the wrong places. Right? And when they say it's not in the charter, what they're saying is the people who are supposed to provide the vision weren't thinking as big as you. And when they say it's political, what they're saying is I've learned to keep my ideas to myself. And when they say it's just traditional, what they're saying is actually I don't know why we do this, but it's always been that way. Okay. And the thing is, they are so easy to refute. Yeah? So when they say things, for example, like "it's too complicated," you say, "I can make it simpler for you." And when they say, "Do you know what, it just sounds like it's too simple," you say, "That's okay, I'll make it more complicated." And my favorite one, a friend of mine got this one the other day, "This isn't what we pay you to do." And his answer was, "That's okay, this one's a freebie." So, if these aren't the real reasons, then what are? What are the real reasons? No. Now, no one will tell you what their real reasons are, but I've been collecting them. I'm going to show you the seven most the classic reasons why people resist change and what to do about them. I'm too full of emotion and fear to think about what you're talking about. This is a big one, yeah? This has all come as a huge shock. That just means thanks for the heads up. No one told me about it, and now I'm just dealing with, you know, horror. I'm scared of the transition, not the idea. Very often we think they don't like the idea. What they're really worried about is the journey to the idea. I don't know how big a deal this change really is. I don't see how I fit into any of this. I feel like I have no say in what happens. This is really what people are saying. And the one that cracks me up, the big one, is this one. I'm fed up with phony change. I want the real thing. Very often when people are saying, no, it won't work, they're not saying they don't want change. They're saying, I want change that's real. I want something I can believe in. So let me take you through these one at a time. I was doing work with a group of people who were supposed to be planning the future of their organization. And 20 minutes before I turned up, they all got fired. Right? And the organizers said, maybe we don't want to do the workshop now. Because it was going to be about the future. And I said, no, actually, this is more the reason why we have to have the workshop now, because we just have a different context. What will the future be for these people? And every time there's something happens, every time there's a change, there's three basic ways you can go about it. You can say, I want to see the positives, I want to see what's interesting about it, or I just want to focus on the negatives. Now, these people who've just been fired, what do you think? The negatives. So instead of trying to change their minds to help them embrace the change, I just said, how do you feel about it? And these were the four things. I'm scared, I'm angry, I feel betrayed, I feel stupid. I let them talk for about 15 minutes, and everything that came out of them was a variation on those same four. And I wrote them down and said, have you got anything new? So after 15 minutes, they were exhausted. There was nothing else to say about the negativity. And then they started saying things like this. You know, I kind of knew this was happening. I've never liked it here. I've only been putting up with this job out of sufferance. In fact, I need a good push. This is the best thing that could happen to me. They got there by themselves, and all I was doing was ratifying their feelings. I was just listening to how they felt. And then, before I knew it, they were here. They were saying, this is great. I'm going to go back to study. I'm going to travel. Why don't we build our own little support group and keep in touch with each other? Now, all of them have got better jobs, and they all keep in touch. Because they went through this whole thing of what's the negatives, the interestings, and the positives. If you've ever seen a small child running and they fall over, for a couple of seconds, they don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. They're not sure. Have you noticed? They just sit there in this kind of neutral space, like, okay, this is different. And what will happen is, if dad says, that was funny, then the kid gets up and does it again. But if mum runs up and she goes, oh, my darling, are you okay? The kid goes, I don't think so. So as children, we have this positive, interesting, negative space. And this interesting space is where the artist is, it's where the innovator is, it's where the inventor is. They'll say, gee, this is unusual, what can we do with this? But as we get older, we compress that space and we see everything in terms of this dichotomy between good and bad. This is good, this is bad. And our default is to react to every change as being bad. So this is a way of people to understand, to audit their emotions about the state. What about this? I'm scared of the transition, I'm not scared of the idea. See, I used to think it was about saying, this is what we're doing at the moment, it's no good. This is where we should be going, it's way better. But what I've realized is the way we do things now have got a couple of good things going for them. The status quo is all of these things. It is known, it is proven, it's familiar. Sure, it's insane, but we know how to do it. We don't have to adjust anything. It's crazy, but it's what we do. You heard that argument? Whereas, what's the problem with B? Well, it's all of this stuff. It's unproven, it's uncertain, it's freaky. Someone told me once, everyone's afraid of something. It's very true. We've all got something we're afraid of. And it could be failure, or ridicule, or clowns. I mean, I don't care what it is. In the unknown, the thing you're scared of could be there. I'm scared of maths. I'm innumerate. So any change where I have to do some numbers, I get very, you know, concerned about. So if the unknown contains maths, I'm nervous. So how do we solve that problem? Well, it's pretty easy. Between where we are and where we're going to get to is all of this stuff. And this is foreseeable, predictable stuff. We know about this. Yeah? I'm someone who, I don't like flying very much. I like coming to Perth, but I don't like getting to Perth. Yeah? So what happens if I have a really turbulent flight? If the captain says it's going to be bumpy, get over it, I'm fine. If he says nothing, I'm imagining at the front of the plane, yeah, the cockpit's on fire and he's madly trying to control us from going at it because I'm not being told. Okay. So this is the trick. It's giving people the heads up. It'll be bumpy. It'll be weird. Just fasten your seatbelts. This will be the ride. I don't know how big a deal this change really is. I love this one. We think about this idea of four doors. The first door, are the things that we used to be able to do and can still do. I get people to write a list. What are things that we could do before the change that we could still do? So I know one organization that said to its staff, you're going to be working from home in whatever hours you like. Everybody freaked out. And we said, okay, what are the things that won't change? Will we still have email? Will we still make phone calls? Will we still be in the same business? Yes. A long list of things that weren't going to change. Oh, everyone calms down. Door number two are the things that we couldn't do before and we still can't do. Make a list. Well, we can't put poison in our product, and I suppose we can't cheat or lie or steal or, you know, that kind of thing. That's also a long list. Door number three are the things that we could do before and we can't do now. In this case, it was get stuck in peak hour traffic and have long meetings that go nowhere. Gosh, could you sacrifice those? You can for door number four. That's a door that's only recently opened. And these are the things we couldn't do before, but we can do now. It means I can make my job suit my lifestyle. I can get away from this work-life balance thing and start thinking work-life harmony. You see some sense in this? And so what we're really asking you to do is to say, guess what? This is what we currently do. This is all the stuff that won't change. This is the stuff we're asking you to let go of. This is the stuff you get to do in exchange. And suddenly, everybody calms down. They can see the change has got edges to it. Okay. I don't see how I fit in any of this. People feel like they're not being consulted. The key to this is the difference between authorship and ownership. What we do is we say to people, here's the change. Own the change. Gosh, why aren't people having ownership of the change? You've seen this happen. I'm going to say, here's why we've got to change. Here's what has to change. Here's how it's got to change. And you report to me. And by the way, I want you to own it. It doesn't work. What works is authorship. If you say, here's why we have to change, here are some things that have to change, but you tell me how. You tell me how you're going to make it work. You give them authorship. You empower them to design the change for themselves. And suddenly it's not, they're not responding to change, they're taking control of change. Here's one of my favorite techniques for this, what we call the renovator's delight. You think about it. If you ever renovated a house, what did you keep? What did you chuck? What did you change? What do you add? They're the only four questions. And we talk to organizations and say, take this tool. What would you do? What would you keep? They say, we would keep our values. We'd keep our passion. We'd keep our enthusiasm. We'd keep our best people. What would you chuck? We'd chuck our negativity, right? We'd chuck our systems. We'd get rid of the bureaucracy and the red tape. What would you change? We'd change our culture. We'd change our attitude. We'd change our thinking. What do you want to add? We want to add empowerment and innovation and creativity and fun. Guess what? They've just designed all the things that we thought we'd have to convince them to do. Now it's their idea. Can you see the power in this? They've been given authorship. They're given the power around to make the change. Okay. Yeah, but people hate change. Don't they? Well, if this is true, we've got to tell the fashion industry right away. Because they are based entirely on the idea that people want to change their look. And we'd better talk to the tourism industry as well, because apparently people don't want to go to other places. Yeah, I mean, and all those people in gyms and those people are trying to lose weight and people having cosmetic surgery or getting their hair done, we've got to tell them how much they hate change. And people who have elections and people who have affairs, we've got to tell them too. No, apparently you hate change. It's not true. Guess what? Bored people want change. Frustrated people want change. Passionate people want change. Irritable people. Cynical people. Actually, the number of people who want change is much greater than we imagine. It's not true that we hate it. In fact, this is closer to the truth. When I take a brief on working with a group, I'll be told our people don't want change. And I listen very carefully to what people say. And what's interesting is as the conversation evolves, it's not that they don't want change. The truth is down in here somewhere. The truth is they want real change. They're sick of believing something that isn't real. They want something genuine. So let's look at that. The thing is, we've all dealt with this before. We know what it is. We know how the lack of change can get packaged up as something new, and we're savvy to it. Someone comes in and says, behold my people, we're going to do it differently, we're going to change everything else. You go, yeah, 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 this is just new look VAM. You know, it's just a repackaging. So how do we know the difference? And is it likely that we now suspect all change as being fake? We think, you know what, you know, you tricked me once in 1972, I'm not believing you again. I've heard all this before, because that's the problem. See, real change sounds very much like fake change. It's hard to pick the difference. So here's the thing. I do work in, well, probably every sector, commercial, non-commercial, government, I mean, any group you can think of, not-for-profit. I ask people how do they spend their time? Where does their career go? How do they estimate their use of time? This is the first map that I get, which is there's a very large amount of our time is spent just staying out of trouble. Yeah? The three rules in any organization is attract praise, avoid blame, don't stand near the fan. And we learn this, yeah? And when you think about how is the rest of the time broken up? Well, there's an awful lot of turf squabbling going on. Who's in charge? Who's the boss? Who's got the biggest desk? And then let's allow some time for, you know, just office intrigues. So what ends up happening is this tiny little sliver for actual achievement. And you know what? I've been running this as an unofficial straw poll now for 15 years, and everyone says it's basically what it looks like. So when I say, here is a change, you can go, yeah, you know what? This is more of the same. Guess what? I think people are hungry for that little green wedge there. I think people are hungry for actual achievement. I don't believe that we want to dedicate our lives to nothing. I don't believe that we're here so that we can achieve zero. I think we're here so it amounts to something somehow. So let's look at that. Your clock's gone crazy, but that's okay. Is the change real or fake? That's an important question. Is this a genuine opportunity or is it phony? I think that's an important question. By the way, fake change, no good. Real change, good, just in case you weren't sure. Is the change cultural or structural? This is a huge question, right? Structural change.
You see what he says there about fake change and real change. So there's fake change and there's real change. Fake change is basically you faking it and you looking like you changed, but you know you haven't changed. But then it's still going because, I mean, it looks good on you, but it's not real change. And then real change is deep within your soul and in your movement, in your actions, in your word, in everything that you are, you've changed.
We change the reporting, we change the org chart, we change the name of the organization, and everything keeps going the same way. Until you change the way we think, unless you change the actual culture, you have zero change. Does that make sense? And then finally, is the change offered or foisted? Am I invited to the change? Am I invited to the change or am I forced to make change? And guess what? Real change, which is cultural and offered, works. Fake change, which is structural and foisted, doesn't work and shouldn't work. So let me show you how to break that up. If I'm talking to you now, you've got two choices, really. Your minds could be open or closed. That's your choice. I can't affect that as well. You could say, you know what? I'm not buying a thing this guy says. That's your right. Or you could go, yep, I'm totally into it. That's also your choice. Yeah? This is the choice that any group that you talk to will make. I have choices as well. I could be talking about something genuine or something phony. That's my choice. So what are the outcomes of the choices that you can make and the choices that I can make? Let's look at them. Let's imagine that you've got your mind open and what I have for you is nothing. This is just phony, phony change. You know what that means for you? Big disappointment. You've got your hopes up one more time. And you've been let down one more time. That's what that means. So what would happen, though, if this was an empty, shallow badging and you went, nah, I'm not buying it, then you win. You reserve the right to say, I told you so. I didn't buy that for a second. It didn't fool me. But what about this? What if your mind is shut and we have a real opportunity here? If we're talking about something genuine, guess what? You lose the opportunity. You lose the possibility. But what if your mind is open and what I'm telling you is real? Then here's where we are. We have an opportunity to make a real difference. So when I work with very cynical closed groups, I present them with this choice. I'll say, here's your choice. You have the choice to close your mind, to lose a rare opportunity to make change for the right to say, I told you so. Or you could give this a fair chance and open your mind and risk disappointment for the chance of making a difference. When you lay it out like that, the choice is practically pretty straightforward. This is my belief about people. What are we here for? What do we want? If you're a young person, the conversation is about destiny. If you're an old person, the conversation is about legacy. But it's still the same. What was I here for? What did I do? What did it amount to? I ask people, how do they want to be remembered? What is it for them? Here lies me. I protected the status quo. Do you think that that turns anybody on? Do you think anybody wants that to be their life's achievement? What about this one? I met all my KPIs. I satisfied all departmental and OH&S standards. Do you think that this excites anyone? Do you think anyone will give their life to this? Or this one? Is this a life? Is this a death? I don't think anybody wants this. I don't think anybody wants this. My belief is a fundamental human need.
USAF's shelves are stocked with fresh produce, pantry staples, and more. All at prices you can afford. Pay only $134.99 for selected Lovis premium disposable nappies, $54.99 for 2 kilos Surf hand washing powder, 750 milliliters Polargrid dishwashing liquid, $14.99, and 400 milliliters Dawn hand and body cream, $29.99. You save, I save, we all save at USAF.
Is to contribute, is to make a difference. Is you were here for a certain time and you made something of it. Tolkien said, all we have to decide is what to do with the time we have. I put it in a much simpler terms. For me, you can keep things the same or you can make a difference, but you cannot do both. That is the choice you've got to make. I've made mine, you choose yours. Thank you very much.
Have you ever noticed when you ask someone to talk about a change they're making for the better in their personal lives, they're often really energetic. Whether it's training for a marathon, picking up an old hobby, or learning a new skill, for most people, self-transformation projects occupy a very positive emotional space. Self-transformation is empowering, energizing, even exhilarating. I mean, just take a look at some of the titles of self-help books. Awaken the Giant Within, Practicing the Power of Now. Or here's a great one we can all relate to. You Are a Badass, How to Stop Doubting Your Greatness and Start Living an Awesome Life. When it comes to self-transformation, you can't help but get a sense of the excitement. But there's another type of transformation that occupies a very different emotional space, the transformation of organizations. If you're like most people, when you hear the words, our organization is going to start a transformation, you're thinking, uh-oh, layoffs. The blood drains from your face, your mind goes into overdrive, frantically searching for some place to run and hide. Well, you can run, but you really can't hide. Most of us spend the majority of our waking hours involved in organizations. And due to changes in globalization, changes due to advances in technology and other factors, the reality is our organizations are constantly having to adapt. In fact, I call this the era of always-on transformation. When I shared this idea with my wife, Nicola, she said, always on transformation. That sounds exhausting. And that may be exactly what you're thinking. And you would be right. Particularly if we continue to approach the transformation of organizations the way we always have been. But because we can't hide, we need to sort out two things. First, why is transformation so exhausting? And second, how do we fix it? First of all, let's acknowledge that change is hard. People naturally resist change, especially when it's imposed on them. But there are things that organizations do that make change even harder and more exhausting for people than it needs to be. First of all, leaders often wait too long to act. As a result, everything is happening in crisis mode, which, of course, tends to be exhausting. Or, given the urgency, what they'll do is they'll just focus on the short-term results. But that doesn't give any hope for the future. Or, they'll just take a superficial, one-off approach, hoping that they can return back to business as usual as soon as the crisis is over. This kind of approach is kind of the way some students approach preparing for standardized tests. In order to get test scores to go up, teachers will end up teaching to the test. Now, that approach can work. Test results often do go up. But it fails the fundamental goal of education, to prepare students to succeed over the long term. So, given these obstacles, what can we do to transform the way we transform organizations? So rather than being exhausting, it's actually empowering and energizing. To do that, we need to focus on five strategic imperatives, all of which have one thing in common: putting people first. The first imperative for putting people first is to inspire through purpose. Most transformations have financial and operational goals. These are important, and they can be energizing to leaders. But they tend not to be very motivating to most people in the organization. To motivate more broadly, the transformation needs to connect with a deeper sense of purpose. Take Lego. The Lego Group has become an extraordinary global company. Under their very capable leadership, they've actually undergone a series of transformations. While each of these has had a very specific focus, the North Star linking and guiding all of them has been Lego's powerful purpose: inspire and develop the builders of tomorrow. Expanding globally, it's not about increasing sales, but about giving millions of additional children access to Lego building bricks. Investment and innovation, it's not about developing new products, but about enabling more children to experience the joy of learning through play. Not surprisingly, that deep sense of purpose tends to be highly motivating to Lego's people. The second imperative for putting people first is to go all in. Too many transformations are nothing more than headcount-cutting exercises, layoffs, under the guise of transformation. In the face of relentless competition, it may well be that you will have to take the painful decision to downsize the organization, just as you may have to lose some weight in order to run a marathon. But losing weight alone will not get you across the finish line with a winning time. To win, you need to go all in. You need to go all in. Rather than just cutting costs, you need to think about initiatives that will enable you to win in the medium term, initiatives to drive growth, actions that will fundamentally change the way the company operates, and very importantly, investments to develop the leadership and the talent. The third imperative for putting people first is to enable people with the capabilities that they need to succeed during the transformation and beyond. Over the years, I've competed in a number of triathlons. You know, frankly, I'm not that good. But I do have one distinct capability. I am remarkably fast at finding my bike. By the time I finish the swim, almost all the bikes are already gone. Real triathletes know that each leg, the swim, the bike, the run, really requires different capabilities, different tools, different skills, different techniques. Likewise, when we transform organizations, we need to be sure that we're giving our people the skills and the tools they need along the way. Kronos, a global software company, recognized the need to transfer from building products, software products, to building software as a service. To enable its people to take that transformation, first of all, they invested in new tools that would enable their employees to monitor the usage of the features as well as customer satisfaction with the new service. They also invested in skill development so that their employees would be able to resolve customer service problems on the spot. And very importantly, they also reinforce the collaborative behaviors that would be required to deliver an end-to-end seamless customer experience. Because of these investments, rather than feeling overwhelmed by the transformation, Kronos employees actually felt energized and empowered in their new roles. In the era of always-on transformation, change is a constant. My fourth imperative, therefore, is to instill a culture of continuous learning. When Satya Nadella became the CEO of Microsoft in February 2014, he embarked on an ambitious transformation journey to prepare the company to compete in a mobile-first, cloud-first world. This included changes to strategy, the organization, and very importantly, the culture. Microsoft's culture at the time was one of silos and internal competition, not exactly conducive to learning. Nadella took this head-on. He rallied his leadership around his vision for a living, learning culture, shifting from a fixed mindset where your role was to show up as the smartest person in the room to a growth mindset where your role was to listen, to learn, and to bring out the best in people. While early days, Microsoft employees already note a shift in the culture. Clear evidence of Microsoft putting people first. My fifth and final imperative is specifically for leaders. In a transformation, a leader needs to have a vision, a clear roadmap with milestones, and then you need to hold people accountable for results. In other words, you need to be directive. But in order to capture the hearts and minds of people, you also need to be inclusive. Inclusive leadership is critical to putting people first. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and right now, our basketball team is the best in the league. We won the 2015 championship, and we're favored to win again this year. There are many explanations for this. They have some fabulous players, but one of the key reasons is their head coach, Steve Kerr, is an inclusive leader. When Kerr came to the Warriors in 2014, the Warriors were looking for a major transformation. They hadn't won a national championship since 1975. Kerr came in and he had a clear vision and he immediately got to work. From the outset, he reached out and engaged the players and the staff. He created an environment of open debate and solicited suggestions. During games, he would often ask, "What are you seeing that I'm missing?" One of the best examples of this came in Game 4 of the 2015 Finals. The Warriors were down 2-1 when Kerr made the decision to change the starting lineup. A bold move by any measure. The Warriors won the game and went on to win the championship. And it is widely viewed that that move was the pivotal move in their victory. Interestingly, it wasn't actually Kerr's idea. It was the idea of his 28-year-old assistant, Nick Uren. Because of Kerr's leadership style, Uren felt comfortable bringing the idea forward. And Kerr not only listened, but he implemented the idea and then afterwards gave Uren all the credit. Actions all consistent with Kerr's highly inclusive approach to leadership. In the era of always-on transformation, organizations are always going to be transforming. But doing so does not have to be exhausting. We owe it to ourselves, to our organizations, and to society more broadly to boldly transform our approach to transformation. To do that, we need to start putting people first. Thank you.
Start putting people first. Start putting yourself first. It is what it is. So ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about change and we're talking about how to know if you have really honestly changed. So our previous speakers were basically talking about the road to change and the circumstances of change and how we get to change and change, change, change. Now, part of the previous speakers' conversation.
Onda karhandu yako parates. Moro data. Paife, o hantimo kuyadi. Nondaka, ne data, no shoyo o utungwarakava hupi. O netwe kaimwe, o kufutarumwe, o kuinyengarumwe, o kujapandali. Fio papa ndauka. O ndapomga o netwe kaoyo, hai dira dira, ya fange. O mafikwa amwe, o handi streaming. O mafikwa amwe, o handi popi. O mafikwa amwe, o handi ningaishe, po shikanto shimwe. Pamwina parateza, uinda holora, ameha ishipangere, osho, paumwene. Dira dira, umakota fanoni, data, momkaro wili, mwana parika, okutuma koutumaraka, okustreaminga, no kudenga pamwina parates. Konga, parates, Namibia. Always, always prepare.
Okay, I think it's fair to say that some people find it hard to make the positive changes that they want in their life, regardless of race, creed, color, social, economic status. I've worked with military veterans and their post-traumatic stress, trying to conquer the traumatic thoughts and the associated feelings that run through their body. The anxiety sufferer who's so consumed by worry that they haven't left their house for days or perhaps weeks on end. Or maybe just the smoker who wants to break that habit so they can live longer and spend more time with their loved ones. The person who wants to make a simple dietary change and stop eating a food that's causing problems and start eating healthily. Or maybe the CEO, the business person, who wants to get up on stage and public speak so that they can rise up the ladder. All these things affecting so many people. And so today I'm going to talk about how we can create a space that allows these changes to occur more easily. But I'm sure some of you, and I don't know who the guilty parties are, might think that when it comes to change, perhaps it's easier than you think. And it always reminds me of this comedy skit by Mad TV. And you can see it on YouTube. It's very, very funny. And it goes something like this. You have this lady who's suffering from this absolutely terrible claustrophobia. Very, very concerned about being buried alive in a box was her specific issue. And she walks in to see the psychiatrist who's sitting there, and he listens very, very intently to what she has to say. And she goes on and on and on about how this is affecting her life. And after she's kind of finished her diatribe, he says, well, I'm going to give you two words. And I would like you to take these two words into your life and notice how they change things. And so she's there very, very patiently. She goes, shall I write them down? He goes, no, I think you're going to be okay. It's just two words. And she goes, waiting. And he just goes, stop it. Just stop it. It's very funny. It's very, very funny. And of course, I'm sure some of us, when we see our friends or our loved ones, or even people with, you know, rather mammoth disorders, sometimes you're just thinking, why don't you just stop it? Good grief, just stop it. And sometimes we can. It is true. But a lot of the time, people can't. Sometimes I often hear people say, well, when you want to change, you just need to believe in yourself. We hear this a lot, you know, these days. Just believe in yourself. If you just believe in yourself, anything can happen. But it always reminds me of the late, great comedian Bill Hicks and his observations on people who took hallucinogenic drugs. And as a result of taking the hallucinogenic drugs, they believed that they could fly. In fact, such was their belief that they went to the top of very high buildings and jumped off. I think we'd call that a fatal belief. But the thing that Bill did was very funny. He goes, well, look, surely if you really believed that you could fly, you would try taking off from the ground first. Yes? After all, you don't see 20 geese going up into the elevator to the top of a building to take off. They know. So belief's a funny thing. Most of the time, you know, a belief requires evidence for it to make any change. Now, when it comes to what I do, we need to find out that stopping it or telling people just to stop it doesn't really work. And also telling people they just need to believe themselves doesn't really work. And I found this out very, very solidly when I did a project in Sydney. And I did a project with Taronga Zoo in Sydney. And I ran a program called Fearless at Taronga for 7 years. And for 6.5 years, we had a 100% success rate in helping people overcome their animal phobias. The first 6 months were a little wobbly, but those 6.5 years, they were really solid. And we help people eliminate and take control of severe phobias, normally around spiders, snakes, those kind of things. And the funny thing was, these people would come in, and they were so desperately frightened, so desperately kind of out of control with their phobia, that we had to kind of find a way of relaxing them. And so what we did is, when they came in, we would offer them ways of winning cash, two ways of winning cash, which was a bit peculiar on a phobia course, I'm sure. And the first way that you could win cash was the person who could present the most extraordinary phobic reaction. Now, bearing in mind we've had people faint, pass out, be sick, sprint hysterically out of the room, you really had to work hard to win that cash prize. And the second cash prize that people could win was the person with the best origin story for their phobia. And that title was held for 4 years by a lady who believed that spiders had hunted her down through seven lifetimes with the sole purpose of making her life a total misery. So you can see that when you have people like this, just telling them to stop it and just telling them to believe in themselves doesn't really kind of cut the mustard, you know? Anyway, I want to get on and talk more about this space, but before I do so, I need to give you a little bit of kind of behind-the-scenes knowledge, as it were. And I'd like you to imagine, just for a moment, that you're in a game show. And in this game show, you have two buzzers. You've got a buzzer here, and you've got a buzzer there. And this buzzer is controlled by your conscious processing, your conscious mind. And this buzzer is controlled by your unconscious processing, your unconscious mind. And whoever gets to press the button first out of these two parts of you gets to choose the next response to the moment. They get to choose the next response to the moment. And now I want you to imagine that we take this into a setting. Let's say, for example, a new social, you know, experience. You know, you're going to a new social party or some kind of social experience, and you decided that you want to go in there and do confidence with your conscious mind. You said, oh yeah, I'm going to be confident. And so you're going to walk in and you're going to do your fancy pants confidence. But as you kind of walk in, all of a sudden something happens. What happens is this bloody unconscious just starts hitting its button again and again and again, and all of a sudden you find yourself feeling nervous, worried, consumed by certain thoughts, what people are thinking of you, and you're doing the absolute opposite of confidence. So how does that occur? Well, it occurs because although there's no agreed upon speed, if you take the mean from all the research studies, we find that the conscious processing travels at about 100 miles per hour around your brain. But your unconscious processing travels about 100,000 miles per hour around your brain. So what this means is your conscious mind's kind of going, confidence, as the unconscious is just going, no, 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 you need to do something else, what I tell you to do. And so it seems to me that actually, contrary to what most people believe, our unconscious actually meets the moment first. And your conscious mind is more of an observer to what your unconscious has already dictated or decided that it's going to occur. In fact, we can take this further, and we can get to the meat of this, which is this 7 seconds. So, I don't know about you, but when I was kind of, up until very, very, very recently, whenever I heard about brain scan equipment or brain scans, the only image that ever came to my mind was that Rick Moranis in Ghostbusters, you know, with a colander on his head and all the little kind of, you know, things coming out of him. And, you know, this lady has prepared one. And I was sorely disappointed when, you know, brain scans don't actually look like that. They look far more like this, which isn't good if you've got claustrophobia. But, and this is called a functional resonance imaging machine, magnetic resonance imaging machine. And it just basically is a fancy kind of brain scan. And this piece of equipment was used by a Dr. John Dylan Haynes from Berlin University, a neuroscientist. And about 6 years ago, he did some research, was quite extraordinary, and it certainly made him sit down for 3 days when he heard it, and made me ever lie down when I heard it. And what he found was that the unconscious had dictated or decided a decision that your conscious mind thought that it had made a second before you actually made it. So again, more of this confirmation that your conscious is just an observation to what your unconscious dictates. In fact, it goes deeper, and he really had to lie down when he found this out. He found out that your unconscious often predicted the decision or the response that it was going to make to the moment up to 7 seconds before your conscious mind was aware of what was going on. And I really think we need to look at that. I mean, that's 7 seconds. So imagine that you decide, say, for example, you're given an arbitrary decision to pick a number between 1 and 10 or something like this, and you think that you just made that decision. Let's pick 3 or let's pick 7. But 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 seconds earlier, your unconscious had begun to pattern recognize everything that was going on and begin to decide and dictate what response you were going to make. This is extraordinary. So let's talk about this space that I'm talking about. Now, to talk about this space that we can create that will allow us to begin to make changes in such a way that the changes we make become a part of our unconscious programming, as it were, so that they become our immediate response. So we don't have to think about it. Instead, we can deliver that response from our unconscious. And to create that space, I believe we need to look at two parts of the brain that people far smarter than me have told me about. And the first part of the brain is what they call the amygdala. And the amygdala, as I've been told, is your emotional processing unit within your brain. It's to do with your emotion, level of emotional arousal at any given point in time, and we often hear it associated to the flight and fight response. The second part that we want to look at is the frontal lobe. And this part of the brain is to do with reasoning, rationality. It's more to do with the modern brain. It allows us to critique situations and basically be able to think in opposite, be able to kind of work things out and compare and contrast. And when these two parts of the brain are being used successfully, we can do extraordinary things. And when they're being used kind of successfully again, but against us, we can start feeling all of the things that we don't want to feel and behaving in ways that we don't want to behave. So, let me give you an example. This gentleman here, I'm going to get my pointer out here. If we go to the Royal Journal of the Scientific Obvious, we can begin to see some effects of the amygdala in action. We can see some nice sweating here, a bit of sweating here. And we can see a nice pallid face here. And we can begin to diagnose that he's suffering from a case of being scared shitless. Okay? And we need to help this this young lad to a different solution. And so how do we do that? Well, think about it this way. When we go into a situation, say, for example, you know, a public speaking situation, for those of you who don't enjoy it, what we can do is we can go on and someone can say, oh, just stop it. You'll be fine. Just believe in yourself. Get out there. Okay. And so you go, okay. And then this occurs. So why does this occur? Well, it occurs because as you go in, your amygdala is highly aroused. Okay. Its flight fight response is being very, very sensitized. It's being kind of set off, as it were. And as a result of that, your critical faculty can think about the opposite. And instead of thinking about what you want to deliver and what you want to do, it begins to think about the opposite. Because of this contrasting ability within the mind. The same can occur if, you know, I've helped lots of people, you have fears of flying, fears of anything. It's the same thing. You tell them just to think calmly and relaxed. You just imagine going in there feeling calm and relaxed at ease. And all of a sudden they think about it, their amygdala kicks in, and they start thinking the opposite. So what we need to do is we need to create a space where we can begin to soothe this amygdala so it has a neutral emotional response to what is being said. And then give suggestions or give information in such a way that it's not critiqued. It's just taken on board as the new behavior or the new suggestion. Now, there are many, not many really, there are a few kind of approaches currently that are doing this kind of thing. We've got hypnosis, for example. And hypnosis very effectively does a similar, not the same, but a similar kind of thing to what I'm talking about. The only problem with hypnosis is it's greatly misunderstood, so much misinformation out there about it, that it gets exhausting trying to tell people what it actually is and get through what they think it is. Another thing is meditation. Meditation uses a very similar state to what I'm talking about. But meditation is more of a witnessing, more of an observation of thoughts, more of a witness on thought. It's not really a volitional action, a volitional control or changing of thoughts. But both of those things that I'm talking about, hypnosis and meditation, very much share the same state if we were to look at it from a neuroscience perspective. But I'd like to kind of create a new term or coin a new term that I believe that I call functional awareness. And this functional awareness state is this neutralizing of the amygdala and this kind of bypassing or dissociation of the critical faculty so that we can think about what we want to think about. So how do we do it? Well, really, at the end of the day, we do it using, you know, our modern mind. We use our amazing powers of language and imagination. And just these two skills, when used skillfully, can create this space in minutes. No more than that, just minutes. And the reason why this is so important, and really to conclude, is it's my idea that I'm really sharing with you today, that if the healing professions, if the change work professions, clinical psychology, psychotherapy, counseling, coaching, whatever it may be that are wanting to help people get from where they are to where they want to be, when they want to help someone who isn't doing rational thought, who isn't just stopping it when we tell them to stop it, who, regardless of all of the time and hours they spent trying to believe in themselves, it's not working. When all of that doesn't work, I believe that if these professions spent far more time really understanding and accepting the reality of our unconscious dominance, and accepting and understanding that by creating states in our mind, states in our brain where change is more likely to occur, our veterans, anxiety sufferers, you, me, everyone who wants to change a habit, a behavior, whatever it may be, will be able to do it far, far more successfully. Hope it's been enjoyable. Enjoy the day.
Over the next few minutes, I don't plan to change the blueprint of your life, your career, or even your tomorrow. But I do plan to challenge what you think about it, because what I've learned has changed my tomorrows, my career, and my life. But before I start, I want to introduce you to someone who's here with me today. This is Uncle Harry. Oh, you can't see him? Oh, then picture this. Uncle Harry's a little shorter than me, a lot grayer. He has this bushy mustache, wears a white lab coat with a black stethoscope around his neck, and always has this unlit cigarette dangling out of his mouth. He served with distinction in the Canadian Navy in World War II, and went on to become one of Montreal's most beloved pediatricians. All his little patients called him Uncle Harry. In fact, many of them still do. So I'm 19 years old, just returned from a European vacation, with a great tan, a bushy haircut, and a long beard, ready to begin my major in biology at McGill University, headed towards, well, I'm not sure where I'm headed. Which is why I go to see Uncle Harry for advice, he being a doctor and all. But what he tells me is not what I expect. Norm, he says, think of your career as a river, and you have a choice. You can launch your boat in the water and paddle upstream towards a goal you think you want, only to find you arrive there exhausted, and it isn't what you want. Or you can steer your boat downstream and find all the bends and turns which provide you opportunities you never could have imagined. That's what I did, and I've had the most incredible career. And one more thing, Norm. Whatever it is you do, make sure you come to love it. Wow. That was very serious advice. So what did I do with it? I think I did what most first-year university students would do. I gathered together with my buddies, and we went to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show about 15 times. No, I never discussed Uncle Harry's advice with anyone for almost 40 years. But it's just a few weeks later. I'm standing in my first biology lab at McGill University. It is huge. We're in the big leagues. There are microscopes all over. I'm standing in front of one looking for a fungus. And I move my slide up and down, back and forth, and I see nothing. And I keep trying, and I'm just getting more frustrated, and I start to sweat because there's this impatient line growing behind me. Finally, I find that fungus. At this point, I have another F word for it. And then I feel this presence behind me and this little whisper. You're never going to love this. I bend over, pick up my backpack, head down the corridor to my course advisor's office. Barbara, how do I get out of this? Well, Barbara listens to my rant, and being the scientist she is, she keeps a very straight face, and finally just asks me two questions. Norm, forget about school for a minute. What is it you like, and what interests you? Oh, well, that was easy. Math, logical puzzles, argument. Barbara helps me find a law course being given the next semester to replace the lost lab credit. Legal Problems of the Poor. It's being given by a young Montreal lawyer by the name of Bob Cooper. Well, you know how it is when you really connect with a teacher? Bob and I hit it off. In fact, by the end of the semester, Bob has me convinced to make an application to law school. He even writes me the letter of reference that helps me get in. Bob Cooper changed the course of my river. But you want to know something else? Bob Cooper didn't love being a lawyer anymore. He told me he had this dream of becoming a film producer. We'll roll the camera forward 20 years, and Bob Cooper has become the president of HBO Pictures in Los Angeles. He then goes on to work for Steven Spielberg at DreamWorks and forms his own film and television production company and becomes one of my clients, Uncle Harry's River. But it was way more complicated than that. So let me start with the night that I met Pierre Elliott Trudeau. He had just shocked the country by announcing he was resigning as prime minister and was going to join a small Montreal law firm, Heenan Blakey, where I happened to be working as a young lawyer. Well, Roy Heenan was so excited with the national news that he held a little soiree at his house for all of us to go meet Mr. Trudeau. I went, but I didn't really want to be there. I don't know about you, but I wasn't really comfortable in those kind of social environments. I'm terrible at small talk. I'll have to say something to him, and he's never going to remember me anyway. So as soon as it's feasible, I make my excuses, head for the door. And who should be standing there not that far from me with his coat on? Yep, Pierre Trudeau. Well, as we head out into the snowy cold, I get all clammed up. Like, I know I have to say something. And I hear these words coming out of my mouth. Can I offer you a lift home, sir? My little hatchback is parked across the street. There's a car seat in the back. I can't remember when the last time was I cleaned it up. Oh, my God. And he says, yes. Like, what am I going to say? He's maybe the most famous prime minister in Canadian history, and I'm nobody. Well, we get to the car, get in, and I have this flash. We have one thing in common. How are your children? I ask. Well, he starts to talk, and he doesn't stop talking until we get home. I discover that his oldest child, Justin, is just a young teenager, and he's quite disappointed in him. When I was a boy, he said, it was before the days of television, I listened to radio for amusement. I read the classics. But Justin, all he's interested in is watching reruns of this film called Star Wars. And then he said the words I would never forget. I have no idea what is to become of that boy. Who can possibly judge the course of anyone's river? From Star Wars superfan to high school teacher to the Luke Skywalker of Canada. That was his journey. But my boat, it was going nowhere. I felt like I was drifting. In fact, by my year-end review, my boss says to me, Norm, you have a lot of potential. But there's something missing, and I just can't tell you what it is. He couldn't tell me what it was. Was he serious? How could I fix myself if I didn't know what was wrong with me? Well, I went home all depressed, and my wife Sharon talked to me all night. I think I was getting good at listening. And finally she said, Norm, I don't think the problem is you, but there's a problem with your approach. You need to take a little initiative. You need to take charge. Take charge. It was like she lit a flame. Okay, it was more like a match to start, but enough to illuminate Uncle Harry. He didn't say, put your boat in the river. He said, steer it. I was missing a rudder. I went back to work the next day angry, mostly at myself. I'd spent 4 years waiting for the work to arrive on my desk. 4 years waiting for my career to happen to me. Well, no more. From that point on, I took charge of everything in my career. From what I was doing, more important to why I was doing it, and most important to how I could distinguish myself. I found a very narrow area of Canadian tax law to specialize in, the financing of movies and television shows. The industry was still fairly young, and a lot of people thought I should have my head examined because who knew where that was going. But producers in Toronto began to take notice. And that was the interesting thing. I didn't notice a change so much in me as much as in other people's reactions to me. I began to speak with a little more authority. My confidence grew. Cut to the next scene. New Year's Eve, 1989. We're sitting at home. Sharon is pregnant with our fourth child, but I feel something growing in me as well. Something that needs to be born. immediately. And the words just come bursting out. That's it. We're moving to Toronto. That's where our future is. Well, we talked about it all night through the next day. I got ready because I had to go meet with the managing partner of Heenan Blakey. And Peter Blakey is this big, imposing man with a booming voice. Bacall, how can I help you? I was a little nervous. Okay, I was a lot nervous. But I summoned my courage. Peter, I'd like to open the Heenan Blakey office in Toronto. I took charge. Well, 6 months later, the baby is born. We pack up the truck. We move down the 401. Shortly after that, we have our opening party in Yorkville. And who should be there? None other than Pierre Trudeau. And we talk. So that got me to Toronto. Taking charge was the beginning. But it wasn't enough, because did I have any idea how to run an office? I had no idea. No idea how to build an organization. But I was about to learn from a very interesting, inspirational source. My son Brian's getting bullied in grade one. So we start him in karate. And I decide to join him. We walk into the dojo, and I see this sign on the wall. And it says, regardless of the number of years of practice, you will never advance without single-minded determination. Single-minded determination. I understand why it's there. So white belts like Brian and I will fight through those moments of difficulty, the pain. When we look at the black belts and we see we can never be that, we will stick with it. We will be determined. We will develop a fighting spirit. Well, spoiler alert, I stay with the karate for almost 20 years and achieve my third degree, or sandan, in terms of black belt. In fact, to break the tension, I wouldn't mind sparring right now. And I gather Justin used to do some boxing, so bring it on. Oh, but he's got enough problems. Single-minded determination became my mantra. It helped me get through those moments of doubt, when others doubted me, when I doubted myself. Every consultant I spoke to said, there is no way your startup will ever compete with the major firms in Toronto. Not possible. And that became my marketing approach. We are the underdogs. We are determined. We will compete. Cut and fade into the next scene. It's almost 25 years later, and we have done it. We have built this glorious national firm with international dimensions. My career as well has blossomed. I've gone from representing small independent producers to becoming an advisor to major Hollywood studios. I was sitting in the boardroom the day that the decision to produce The Hunger Games was made. How cool was that? In fact, it was unimaginable. And that was my ride. But there was one more thing I needed in my boat that helped me get there. And it wasn't so much something I learned as something that I had to unlearn. And that was that failure was the adversary. It's something you'll also have to unlearn. Failure is not your adversary. It is your teacher. Failure is not the boulder in the river that's going to crush you, unless you let your fear of it crush you. Interesting. See, as managing partner, I learned that one out of every four decisions I made was going to be wrong. One in four. And it wasn't so much about the successes as what I learned from the mistakes and the failures. How we adjusted, how we moved forward, how we were able to compete. So I could give you lots of examples of how I overcame failure and the mistakes that were made and the rejections that we suffered, but I'm only going to give you one. 7 years ago, my boat capsized. I was drowning. 1 year after I'd stepped down from my leadership position, the law firm that I had helped build collapsed. Boom! The shockwaves of the tsunami could be felt from coast to coast. The greatest failure in Canadian law firm history. That's the way the national media was reporting it. In its final 2 months, I returned to a leadership position in an effort to save it. But I failed. 1,100 people out of work. The feeling of loss indescribable. Have you ever lost anything near or dear to you? If you haven't, eventually you will, because it's called life. You see, Uncle Harry's river isn't just filled with opportunities. It's got rocks and rapids, and every once in a while you miss the final turnoff before the falls. So I had a choice. I could give up, drown, disappear into retirement, or I could start over. Now, it's one thing to start when you're in your 20s, but is it any different when you're in your late 50s? I was about to find out. I found a day job and I began to write at night. I had no intention of writing a book. I was pretty certain I could never write a book. But I needed to process my feelings, my anger. I began to write down my stories. And I wrote, night after night, week after week, month after month, until I discovered I was starting to like it. I was exactly where you are right now, discovering an interest, trying to determine if it might lead to another river. There was only one problem. I didn't have sufficient skill as a writer. And that's when it hit me. Flash to the vignettes of Barbara and Bob Cooper, Roy Heenan, Pierre Trudeau, my wife Sharon, my partners, all the mentors along the way. I didn't do it myself the first time. I needed paddlers in my boat. But where to find them? I was home, alone, like so many of us are these days. I went online. I picked up books on writing by Stephen King and others. I read my favorite authors. I looked up a couple of authors online and asked if they wouldn't mind critiquing my work. I got started on my path, on my river. And 7 years later, once more, I am at this unimaginable point in my life. Norman Bacall, author. I stay in touch with Uncle Harry. We talk from time to time. Okay, mostly he listens. But he was right. Success is not a ladder. It's not a straight line. It's filled with bends and turns and falling out of the boat and climbing back in, discovering you didn't drown. You just learned how to swim. So that's been my journey up until now, and it's been a glorious one. But it's taken guts and filled me with exhilaration. But that's been my choice. But what about you? What are you going to choose? And here are my words of advice. Launch your boat in your river. Work on developing your skills. Take charge of your decisions. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. Don't be afraid to fail. Be determined. Work through those moments of doubts. And never be ashamed to ask for help. That is how you can become the person you can't imagine. And as for Uncle Harry, well, once more he's shuffling off the stage, back bent, the gown's hanging a little lower, that cigarette still dangling out of his mouth as he leaves us. He never waves goodbye, because really, he never leaves. This speech has been dedicated to the memory of Dr. Harry Lyon Bacall, member of the Order of the British Empire, 1946, for distinguished military service. May his memory be a blessing, and his legacy his words. And thank you.
At 2 p.m. on January the 20th, 2017, I was walking down the stairs of the High Court in London, wearing handcuffs, and on my way to one of the most violent prisons in England. Having never been arrested, accused, charged, or convicted of a crime, in fact, not even the police knew that I was going to prison. A week before, I was running a successful company with over 50 staff, helping thousands of people, and a week later, I was down to virtually no staff and faced with losing everything I had, including my home. And so began the most incredible adventure I've ever had the privilege of living. How I got there isn't quite as interesting. I was arguing a years-old business deal in court with a major multinational, and one that had far deeper pockets to flex far bigger legal muscles than I did. And when they threw a contempt of court application at me, I didn't give it much credibility. I remember an old longtime friend and business mentor, Dan Pena, once told me that when it comes to business, litigation and civil actions are nothing more than a tool. And I thought this was a chess move to try to pressure me into an early settlement, and I didn't really take it that serious. That was a mistake. I learned a lot about how the court system works, shall we say. And when I was sitting in the hearing, my fiancé turned around to me and said, this isn't going the way we thought it was going to go. You know, what happens? You know, you could even go away here. And I'm like, I don't know why this is happening, honey, but here's what I do know. You know, I've been very blessed, very privileged over the last 20-plus years to have millions of people around the world benefit from my work. I said, but maybe the people that could benefit the most never really get to hear it because they're in somewhere like jail. If the universe, or whatever you want to call it, wants to send me in to hold a light, let me go do my work. And I was reminded by a quote by Tony Robbins, who I had the privilege of working alongside as an experienced trainer for over 15 years. And he said something profound. He said, the strongest force in the human personality is the need to remain consistent with how you define yourself. In other words, your identity. For example, why do vegetarians not eat meat? It's not because they have different teeth or a different digestive system. It's because their identity is, I am a vegetarian. Now, the reason they may choose that identity is personal and varied for either health or moral reasons, but once you adopt that identity, it governs what you order off the menu. So I had a choice walking down the stairs as to which identity I wanted to adopt. I could either adopt the identity of a prisoner and a victim and complaining about the courtroom shenanigans, or I could choose something more empowering, someone who is going in on a mission as a secret agent of change. I remember getting to the prison, and I had my medical. They gave me my clothes, and I sat with a doctor for a while before they gave me a cell. And he leaned over. He says, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. He said, are you undercover? And I smiled. I said, why do you ask? He said, well, in my entire career, I've never seen anybody so happy on their first ever day in prison. I took that to be a good sign. But not even I was prepared for what was about to happen. Let me set the scene for you. Pentonville is a 200-year-old Victorian prison that's never really been modernized. It was built to house over 900 inmates. When I got there, there was over 1,300, including murderers, terrorists, drug lords, you know, armed robbers, to name a few. By the government's own statistic, over 1 in 5 people in the prison population there are on antipsychotic medication, with many more on antidepressants. Violence is epidemic. Drugs are to order. And many of the cells have their own pets in the form of cockroaches and rats. Let's just say that if it was a hotel, it wouldn't do very well on TripAdvisor. In fact, I remember walking into the showers a couple of weeks after I arrived, and this was my first shower in 4 days. And my cellmate walked into one set of showers, I walked into another, and 3 guys followed him in and closed the door behind, and one pulled out a weapon. It was a toothbrush that had been sharpened to a spike on the concrete wall and with razor blades glued into the other side. Crude, but very effective. And they didn't waste time. Now, luckily, they weren't after my cellmate, but somebody that had just walked in ahead of him. And while I didn't witness the attack personally like he did, the blood coming from under the doors in the shower was like something out of a horror movie. In fact, this is what it looks like inside. And this was taken from an article in the paper of somebody else that was murdered just before I got there. Welcome to Pentonville. Now, I'm also a great believer that one of the greatest days in a human being's life on the journey of emotional maturity is the day that we realize that life is not a comfort-centric experience, but a growth-centric experience. I believe that we're in earth school, and for me, this was a practical exam. You know, was I able to actually walk the talk that I've been teaching for so many years in a real environment with no cameras, no second takes? And obviously learn my own lessons that I needed to learn, also about my own ego and some of the things that happen in court. But I believe that, you know, we can be empowered by that. If you can understand that Earth School is here for everybody, but how do you handle that environment in Pentonville? Positive thinking just isn't enough. You need a tool set. And luckily, after 3 decades almost in personal growth, I had a decent tool set. And I want to share a few of those with you here today. Not that you need to go to prison to test these, yeah? Leave that for the idiots like me. But if your son or daughter comes home from having a tough time at school or not getting the grade they want, or your spouse is suffering through having work downsizing or whatever, you may be able to use some of what I was using in order to be able to help you, and that's one of my main purposes here today. Now, one of the first tools I was using is often underrated, and it's the power of acceptance. Most people don't get to acceptance because they confuse it with apathy or resignation. But if you are complaining about something that has already happened, you are wasting your time. As soon as I walked in there, I implemented a zero tolerance policy on my own thinking of any thoughts that started with if only or what if. Why? Because you can't go back and change anything. The milk may be spilt, but that's not going to put it back in the bottle if you sit there and feel sorry for yourself. But by unhooking the energy of resistance and being coming to terms with where you are, you can then free up that energy to channel into whatever the next best move is to deal with what's happened. In fact, one of the first signs that I wrote when I got there and I put over my cell door was taken from the classic Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. In fact, this is the exact sign. It states, every adversity carries with it the seed of an equivalent or greater benefit. The challenge is for most people is that they're so busy focused on the adversity, they don't water the seed. And I'm a great believer that many of the gifts in life that come to us are wrapped in a thin layer of problems, probably to stop somebody else from stealing our gift. One of the other tools I was using was contrast frames. Now, contrast frames are very powerful, and they essentially derive from the fact that most of what we give meaning to is based upon what we compare it to. For example, if you walk into work on a Monday morning and your boss calls you in and he gives you a surprise 10% pay rise, you walk out feeling pretty good. And then at lunchtime, you're chatting with your coworker who essentially does the same job, and you find out that they got called in and got given a 15% pay rise. Now you're not feeling so good. See, you had nothing before, but now you only have 10%. See, the trick with contrast frames is to always contrast where you are with something that makes you empowered rather than disempowered. Many years ago, I ran a tough race, one of the world's toughest ultramarathons across the Sahara Desert, the Marathon des Sables. And I remember on the day of the double marathon, you know, we were at night preparing to run 84 kilometers the next day. And we're in our little sleeping bags in the middle of the desert. It was freezing cold. You know, the sandstorm was blowing in our face. We'd already ran best part of 100 miles. Every part of our body either was bleeding or was aching. And we could feel the camel spiders and the scorpions crawling over our sleeping bag. Man, what I would have given for a prison bed. I also had lots of books sent in to not only stock the library, which is fairly understocked, but also to be able to help prisoners and give them something that I thought would be able to help. And one of the books, and I had many copies sent in, was the classic Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. And I challenged many of the prisoners that were having a tough time, that were open to being helped, to read that book and not cry with tears of gratitude for being somewhere like Pentonville rather than somewhere like Auschwitz. One of the other things that I was doing to make a big difference there was teaching the prisoners the difference between liberty and freedom. You see, all they'd really done was restrict my liberty. As people who have free will, and our decision space had just been made smaller. That was all. I couldn't choose to go to the shops. I couldn't choose to go walk my dogs. I couldn't choose to show up for my wedding that had been planned. But freedom is a state of mind, and nobody can take that away from you. As Gandhi said, nobody can do anything to you emotionally without your permission. Nobody can take your dignity. You can only give it away. I was freer in my little cell than a lot of the prison officers who were coming in that day that hated their job or were going back to a dysfunctional relationship they didn't have the tools or the courage to fix. I also wrote letters every 2 weeks to my senior students and coaching clients, essentially documenting what was happening and teaching them a lot more of the tools that I was using. And it was part journal, part how-to manual, part you couldn't make it up, but it was real. And I was also very raw. You know, I shared the times that I cried. I shared the times that I doubted myself, if I wondered if I was actually making a difference. And those letters started to have an impact, not just for my coaching clients who read them and started to transform, but I also shared them online that started to transform the lives of most people who read them. And that started to bolster me. That started to give me conviction that what I was doing, not just in my little, you know, private mission inside, but on the outside, was also reaching people it could help. And so I decided that from there, I'm going to work harder and double down. And I started working with bigger groups of prisoners. In fact, the secret agent of change job got to be a full-time deal. And whenever they'd let me out of the cell, I'd have a big crowd of prisoners, and I realized I had to leverage my time more. So I wrote a short story. And the story was called Mud or Stars, taken after the old adage that two men sat behind prison bars, one saw mud, the other saw stars. And it was really teaching people that your environment never defines you. It simply gives you the opportunity to define yourself. But I wrote the story out, and I did it in a way that followed a fictional story of a guy coming to prison for the first time, kind of deer in the headlights, all, you know, confused and angry and scared. And he happens to be sitting in the waiting room to be processed and sits next to a wise old prisoner that starts giving him advice. And I chose that because a lot of the times if we go to help somebody and we offer unsolicited coaching or we really want to try and help, but if, you know, we get kickback because, you know, you don't know me, you don't know my story, or even if they want help, the presupposition is that you need fixing. And then that triggers the fear that we all have, which is the fear that we're not enough. And we put up a defensive wall and discount the advice. So I wrote this in a way that allowed people to be enrolled. Because if you sit next to a couple of people that are having a conversation, you're listening in. And it says, oh, wow, that's really interesting. What they're saying is actually good. Your defenses are down because it's not about you. Your guard's down, so you're more susceptible to taking on the input. So I had this story I'd written out by hand, but I needed help to get it into the prison. And that's where the universe stepped in again. The next day, I found myself unsupervised in class. Now, this never happens in Pentonville. But the teacher was waiting for a supply teacher that didn't show up. And so she had to go, and she locked us in the classroom, which is protocol. Now, I found myself in front of a computer and a printer, and I didn't need an invitation. I started typing up the story out of my pocket, and I hit print 50 copies. And by the time she came back, I smuggled them out of the class under my sweater. And I went to work over the next 2 or 3 days as the mystery mailman, sliding them under cell doors at random, leaving them on desks, pinning them up on notice boards. And it didn't take long for the magic to work. Within a few days, you could actually hear some of the most violent or depressed prisoners shouting to each other across the wings, mud or stars, to try to cheer themselves up. And they started to create a movement. In fact, I was so busy with mud or stars and doing all my other things, I ended up, the long and short is that I managed to get a lot of the people off drugs, I was stopping suicides, and really helping work with some of the people that had been let down by the system. And it created such an impact that I vowed that when I came out, I'd be able to create something that new prisoners could be given. And so I created the New Prisoner Welcome Booklet. Because when you are faced with uncertainty, you need something to hang on to. And the challenge is that for many of the systems in the prison, they let prisoners down because they're following an archaic principle of containing criminals, not trying to rehabilitate them. And if they do try to rehabilitate, it's always ineffective because what they do is they try to raise their skill set by educating them, not raise their mindset. Now, behavior follows mindset, not skill set. If you educate somebody without raising their level of consciousness, all you're simply going to do is give them more tools with which to enact the same behavior. So we essentially make them better criminals, which is what most of the statistics will show you in terms of how fast somebody goes and recommits a crime once they're released. So this booklet was designed to really help people shift their mindset and raise their level of consciousness to engender hope rather than give them, you know, no choice at all, which for many is all the choice they had. And I'm very pleased to say this is now being rolled out and used in several prisons across the UK. I was on the phone with somebody from Head of Corrections in New South Wales that want to use it in Australia. I've been talking with a lot of the prisons and charities in the US. You can go to my website and download the source files for this along with all of the image rights to be able to customize it to your own prison or charity. And I'm very pleased to say it's now making a difference to, you know, many people every single month. Now, I share that because every single one of us faces adversity. It's not because we're unlucky, my friends. It's by design. You know, we're here in Earth School to grow and contribute. That's the two laws of nature. And the strongest trees don't grow in the best soil. They grow in the strongest winds. So if you want to become the best version of yourself, start praying for some strong winds and don't complain when they show up. We only have to go to the physical body to see that if you take it to the gym and push it past your limits, it's pre-programmed to return with a better version of itself. What do you think nature's trying to tell us? And so when adversity shows up, as it will, start to try to shift your focus by asking better questions, by looking at what you can learn or who you can become rather than looking at what you could lose, is the difference between a life of success and a life on the street for many people. And if we can focus ourselves on being able to see the positive no matter what, to tear the wrapping paper off and search for the gift in the adversity, then we all have the ability to live a life that's an example rather than a warning. And in doing so, hopefully, leave a legacy that transcends not just ourselves, but impacts many more lives. Thank you.
here today to talk to you about overcoming the biggest obstacle you'll ever face. Let me take you on a journey. It was the middle of the night, almost a year ago. I struggled to breathe. Each step taking longer than the last, I fought my way upward at the cruising altitude of a commercial airliner. Focus, I thought. Keep pushing forward. The combination of 130 days of consecutive climbing, the negative 60-degree wind chill, and the actual physiological state of my body fighting back at 28,000 feet on Mount Everest summit ridge was pushing me to my breaking point. Get a hold of yourself, Colin. I desperately tried to regain control of my mind, but doubt, fear, and pain swirled in my thoughts. One step at a time, I thought. In an apparent daze, a chair appeared in the snow in front of me, blurring in and out of my vision. One step at a time, I thought. These labored steps reminded me of steps I had taken before, steps that had given me a new lease on life, steps that would bring me to my knees, yet simultaneously teach me life's greatest lesson. My mind flashed back. 10 years ago, I had just graduated from college. It was time to let loose, to see the world. I took my life savings from 3 summers painting houses, packed a backpack and a surfboard, and set off into the world for an adventure with no itinerary. After all, adventure is just bad planning, right? 3 months into the journey, I found myself on a beach in rural Thailand. It was a beautiful evening. I was watching fire dancers in amazement, and I decided to partake in the fun, jumping a flaming jump rope, because, you know, I was 22 years old and invincible. In an instant, my life changed. The rope wrapped around my legs and ignited my body completely on fire. Survival mode kicked in when I needed it most, and with one last breath, an ounce of courage, I dove into the ocean a few steps away to extinguish the flames. Then darkness. Silence. I awoke in a one-room nursing station to look down, finding my body completely bandaged. What have I done, I thought. I had been severely burned. Well, it must have been at least 24 hours later, I awoke, leaving a surgery room in a small ICU where there was a cat running across my chest and around my bed, hammering home the fact that I was far from home and in a dire set of circumstances. Being in this unsanitary hospital could kill me. And the pain, the searing pain was unimaginable. Yet the morphine they kept giving me made it feel like there was insects crawling over my skin. I couldn't tell which was worse. I just wanted to give up. I was downward spiraling fast, ready to quit. Thankfully, 5 days in this ordeal, my mother arrived to be my protector. I know now she was just as afraid as I was, but she chose to never show me her fear. Instead, she came into my hospital room every single day with a smile on her face and an air of positivity, daring me to dream about the future. She kept asking me questions like, "Colin, what do you want to do when you get out of here? Let's set a goal." My immediate response, "Mom, I'm screwed. The doctors say I may never walk again normally. What hope do I have? Life as I know it is over." But her positivity was unrelenting and infectious. And 3 days after she arrived, she was sitting on my bedside and I announced my goal. "Mom, when I get out of here, I'm going to one day compete in a triathlon." Not something I'd ever done before, and looking down at my legs, it seemed rather unrealistic. But with a tear in her eyes, she nodded and wrapped me in her arms as only a mother can. It was many more weeks until I was released from that Thai hospital. I still hadn't taken a single step. I was carried on and off the plane and placed in a wheelchair when I got back here to Portland. The next morning, I was in my mother's kitchen. My mom said to me, "All right, Colin, now I know you've got this big triathlon goal, but today your goal is to take your first step." She then grabbed a chair from our kitchen table and placed it one step in front of my wheelchair. You need to figure out how to get out of your wheelchair and step into that chair. It took me 3 hours that day to work up the courage and strength to take that first step. But I did it. The next day she had moved the chair 5 steps away, and the next day 10. Each day I could take a few more steps. Until finally, after many weeks, I regained my ability to walk. And then one day, jog. Jogging felt like flying. But jogging was a far cry from running a triathlon. So for the next 18 months, I grinded with my goal in mind. And finally, a year and a half after my accident, it was time for me to take a shot at my dream. I showed up in Chicago to compete in the triathlon. I dove into Lake Michigan to swim the first mile. I got on my bike, rode 25 miles, put my shoes on, and ran 6.2 miles to the finish, crossing the finish line. I had done it. I had achieved my goal. And there was one more surprise in store for me that day. I hadn't just finished the race. I had won. Thank you. Placing first out of more than 4,000 other participants. The first thing I thought about were those months in the hospital, imagining what would have happened had my mom not forced me to look towards the future and set a measurable goal. Through this tragedy, I'd learned an invaluable lesson. I had learned that life will test us with setbacks, but these situations aren't permanent. We have full control of our choices to keep moving forwards, one step at a time. I had learned that we all have reservoirs of untapped potential and can achieve great things. The biggest thing standing in our way? Our own minds. For the next 6 years, I competed as a professional triathlete in 25 countries. And then, in the fall of 2014, I found myself at the summit of Ecuador's third tallest mountain with a diamond ring in my pocket, asking my longtime girlfriend Jenna to marry me. I don't know if it was the lack of oxygen to her brain due to the altitude, but she said yes. Awed and inspired by the mountains around us and wanting to set a goal larger than ourselves, we set a goal together. I would attempt to set a world record for the Explorers Grand Slam with the larger purpose of inspiring kids everywhere to dream big, to set goals, to live active, healthy lives. We coined our project Beyond 7-2. Now, the Explorers Grand Slam includes climbing the 7 summits, which is the tallest mountain on each of the 7 continents, as well as completing expeditions to both the North and South Poles. Fewer than 50 people in history had ever completed the Grand Slam, and I would aim to be the fastest. It took over a year of hard work for both Jenna and I to put our dream into reality, but finally it was time for me to leave on the adventure. Jenna, ever steady at the helm of the expedition logistics and running our nonprofit, I set off for the mountains. First destination, Antarctica. A tiny little plane landed me onto the frozen continent. The landscape was desolate and surreal. It felt like standing inside the belly of a ping pong ball, white in all directions. And the cold. The cold was something I'd never experienced before. Average temperature, negative 40 degrees. It was so cold that I took a cup of boiling water and threw it into the air. And it immediately turned into ice. After battling these extreme conditions, for the next week, I arrived at the South Pole. And from there, the journey continued onwards. Next, I climbed Mount Vinson, then Aconcagua, then Kilimanjaro. And finally, after 100 days, I had completed 7 of the 9 expeditions to complete the Explorers Grand Slam, and I arrived at Mount Everest Base Camp. After 3 weeks on Mount Everest, I had slowly clawed my way up to the highest camp before the summit, Camp 4. The muscles in my legs felt like ice, cold and hard. My head was pounding, my eyes were bulging, my face was swollen. In any normal circumstance, this would warrant a trip to the doctors. But there were no doctors around. And besides, I knew exactly what was happening. I had read all the literature on Mount Everest, but nothing can truly prepare you for what is known as the Death Zone, above 26,000 feet, an altitude where the human body cannot survive for long. As darkness fell and the wind kicked up, I was exhausted and claustrophobic in my tent. I was scheduled to leave for the summit at midnight, and I was terrified. Doing the only thing I could think of to try to calm my mind down, I reached for my satellite phone and I called Jenna. And in an incredible moment of bravery, Jenna set aside her own justifiable fears and told me exactly what I needed to hear. She said, "Colin, people are going to summit Mount Everest tonight, and there's no reason you can't be one of them. Go inside your body and listen. Face your fears. I know you can do it." And with her words in tow, I set off for the summit, bringing us back full circle to where I began this talk. In the darkness, my headlamp only illuminated the few steps in front of me. Focus. One step at a time. I began counting my steps. One. Two. Ten steps. Could have fooled me. Felt like 10 miles. I felt my body giving up. I was hopeful that the daylight might give me some strength after a long night of climbing, but the sunrise only illuminated the 2 mile drop-offs on either side of me. I was again being tested by the biggest obstacle of all, my mind. But this time I wasn't alone. Jenna's words filled my head. My mom's words filled my head. Remembering those labored steps after my accident filled my head. Strengthened by those thoughts, my mindset shifted, and my body forgot its weakness. I felt a surge of energy, each step taking me closer to the summit. And after a few more hours of hard work, I gazed out on the most magnificent view from the top of the world. We got any Timbers fans out there? Of course, I had to bring a little hometown love with me up there with the Timber scarf on the summit of Everest. After safely descending back down to Camp 4 and crawling into my tent, I reached for my phone again to call Jenna. "How are you feeling?" she said. "Whew, I'm exhausted, but I did it. No frostbite, no injuries, I'm good." She then said something I will never forget. She said, "Colin, I need you to put your boots back on." What? It had literally just taken me more than an hour to take my boots off and crawl back into my tent. She explained. She said she'd been doing some calculations back home, and it just so happened that if I get to the summit of Denali, my last mountain, in the next week, I could set not one, but 2 world records. She said, "I need you to put your boots back on now. Climb back down to base camp. There's a helicopter there that's going to take you to Kathmandu. There's not enough time for a hotel room or take a shower, but an evening flight will take you from Dubai to Seattle to Anchorage, and then you have about 3 days to climb Denali." In that moment, I could only laugh then, right? In that moment, I was forced to wipe the slate clean. And somehow, just 100 hours after standing on the summit of Mount Everest, we executed Jenna's plan, and I arrived at the base of Denali, my final mountain. The next 3 days were quite honestly the hardest of the entire project. I was battling extreme fatigue, and to make matters worse, Alaska dumped a huge windstorm on me. 50-mile-per-hour winds, minus 60-degree wind chills, making me battle and earn each step. But with one last step, on the evening of May 27, 2016, I arrived to the summit of Denali, setting 2 new world records for the Explorer's Grand Slam and 7 summits. Thank you. Jenna and I together had accomplished our seemingly impossible goal. And even better, millions of kids were able to share in on the journey and the accomplishment with us via social media, sharing with us their own goals and their own dreams for the future. I carry this rock with me every day. It's a small rock from the summit of Mount Everest. This rock stands for the moment I chose to keep pushing forward. This rock stands for my untapped potential. As I set new goals and ultimately encounter obstacles, this rock reminds me that even Mount Everest can be broken down to its smallest parts. A bunch of small rocks stacked on top of each other. Many steps leading to the summit. Maybe right now you're struggling in your own day-to-day life, feeling overwhelmed like it's just too much. Or maybe you have a great idea for a business you want to start or an innovation at your current job, but people keep telling you it's not possible. Or maybe you've been badly injured in an accident and you're not sure that you can recover from it. You see, tragedy and other great obstacles befall all of us. And in these moments, our minds are flooded with doubt. We ask ourselves questions like, should I give up? Is this even possible? Or why me? Leading us to a negative mindset. But we don't have to stay there. The only question that we have when facing great obstacles is, how will you respond? You have a choice. And when you shift your mindset towards the positive, you will quickly realize that there is a reservoir of untapped potential waiting to be released by you. Look, I'm just a regular guy from Portland, but I can confidently tell you this. Achievement is not for the select few. Achievement is simply for those who never quit. It is for those who set goals. It is for those who put the most steps in front of the others. Achievement is for those who can overcome the greatest obstacle of all, their mind.
Hi, great achiever.
Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening, too.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Are you achieving great things?
Yeah.
What have you achieved so far?
Nothing.
Yes. But I asked you if you are achieving great things and you said yes, sir. Huh? Hello?
Hi.
Yes, I'm asking. I asked you if you achieved great things. You said yes, and then you. I can't really hear you properly. Alrighty, we are doing the most this lovely evening. We are achieving, we are talking about change and why. And also, how to know when you have achieved change.
So set a goal. Take the first steps. The chair is right in front of you. And when your steps get you there, push the chair further. When you feel like giving up, put your boots back on. Let go of fear. Remember this story. And remember this rock. And watch as your rocks stack up to the summit of your Mount Everest. Thank you very much.
I work as a co-director at a substance abuse and co-occurring mental illness treatment agency. And not a day goes by that I take that for granted. In 1999, I paroled from prison for the second time. For the second time. Apparently, once wasn't enough for me. Yeah, it's pretty scary. That's me. All told, I spent over 8 years in prison, on probation or on parole for numerous felony drug charges. For 10 years, I woke up smoking crack every morning and went to bed smoking crack every night. I spent most of my time trying to escape the helpless, hopeless reality of my life by getting high. On the worst day, I remember selling an $8,000 car that my mom had given me that I loved to my crack dealer for four $20 rocks. That memory is so painful that actually this is the first time I've ever shared it publicly. I came as close to giving up on life as one can without jumping off. But something extraordinary happened to me the second time I went to prison. About 2 months into my sentence, I got a letter from my ex-wife telling me that my mother, the person I professed to love and care about more than anyone in the world, had had a heart attack and was likely going to die. This wasn't my biological mother who had abandoned me shortly after I was born, but the real mother who had raised me as her own for all of my life. I was forced to look at what kind of person I had become. And the person I had become was not easy to look at, because I had become the son who would not be there to comfort his 77-year-old mother, laying all alone in a stark hospital room when she needed him the most, because of my selfish need to escape my realities by getting high. In a moment of brutal honesty, I had to admit I had been living a lie. I was not the loving son or the faithful partner or the supportive father or the good citizen that I had been telling everyone, including myself, for years. It was then that I decided that I needed to try to change my life into something that I and my mother, wherever she might be, could be proud of. And a tiny seed of change was planted deep inside me. So after my release from prison, I decided I would go back to school, because I figured, what better place can a middle-aged, 240-pound black ex-convict go to blend in than a white bread community college with a whole bunch of 20-something co-eds? But I was fortunate. I was fortunate because at the local junior college where I landed, I ran into two instructors that changed my life. It was my interactions with these instructors that helped me to regain the self-worth and purpose and meaning and confidence that my drug use and drug-related lifestyle had stolen from me. I'll never forget the moment that I realized that I understood that I could create my own miracle. It all started when I went up to one of Professor Senna's office hours, fishing for some special praise, because that had become my new drug of choice. She listened to me describe some super cool thing I had just done. And with no pomp and circumstance, she looked at me and said, "Isn't it amazing, BJ, what a person can do when they start believing in themselves?" And then, as if nothing special had happened, she turned back to her desk and what she was doing. Well, I walked away from that office hour dazed and confused and wondering what had happened. I was also a little pissed because she hadn't fed my new habit. But I was forced to think about what had happened and what did it mean. And importantly, that seed of change that was deep inside me started to stir. A couple months later, while taking a test, Professor Miller walked by my desk and dropped off an application that I later discovered was to the Masters of Counseling program at Sacramento State University. So after the test, I hurried up to his office hour and run into his office and held up the application and very obtusely said, "What's this?" And without hesitation, he responded, "I'm quite confident in your ability to read, so I'm sure you can figure that out on your own." So I brilliantly followed that up with an equally obtuse question. I said, "So do you think I can do this?" And with patience, but no special fanfare, he looked at me and said, "Of course. Of course." And then he too turned back around to his desk, signaling that we were done. And again, I stumbled away from an office hour, dazed and confused. But this time, the seeds of believing in myself that had been planted in my garden of self-doubt took root and started to grow. In a moment, I realized that the only person left to believe in me that needed to believe in me was me. As my tears started to well up in my eyes, for the first time since I had left prison, I felt free. After 3 years, I finally felt free of the mental and emotional shackles caused by the shame and the pain and the despair of my years of drug use. For years, I and people like me had been told, once an addict, always an addict. Once a criminal, always a criminal. Once a loser, always a loser. But I realized that was only true if you believed it. I have learned the hard way how paralyzing self-doubt can be. It contributes to people choosing misery over joy and emptiness over fulfillment and imprisonment over freedom, and unnecessarily so. In 2006, only 7 years after I walked off the yard at Corcoran State Prison, I walked across a stage and I was conferred my doctorate in clinical psychology. Sitting in the middle of the third row was a woman who had spent countless sleepless nights worrying about her son. That woman was my then 85-year-old mother, who did not die while I was in prison. But lived to see me become the man she always believed I could be. Prior to 1999, this was my life, without hope or purpose. Today, this is my life. Now, I want to say here that I'm often frustrated when I hear people attribute a person's successful recovery or rehabilitation to a miracle, as if their hard work and perseverance had nothing to do with it. I needed to say that because it was regaining my belief in myself that gave me the power to change the direction of my life, and is what allows me to now provide hope to others facing similar challenges. Because I'm living proof. I'm living proof that a person's past does not have to define their future. Now, you don't have to go to prison to learn the lessons I have. In fact, I really wouldn't recommend it. But know this. We do have a choice whether we want to have our past define us or refine us. And as I tell the thousands of individuals struggling with addictions and other painful life challenges that come through our clinic, you don't have to wait for a miracle. You can create your own. Thank you.
You don't have to wait for a miracle. You can create your own. And how do we create our own, my friends? It is by changing the bad things that we don't want to change, by changing the things that no longer serves a purpose, and also by noticing the change. So how do we know if we've changed? We notice consistency. We notice our thoughts. We notice our feelings. We notice our achievements, and we notice our reactions. Signs of positive change. One is increased gratitude and kindness. You appreciate your loved ones more and show them kindness And you also practice kindness with everybody. And then number two, greater patience and forgiveness. You are more understanding and less likely to hold on to resentment. There. That one's a difficult one, but okay. And then the third one is self-awareness and acceptance. You understand yourself better, are more accepting of others, and don't compare yourself to others. Number four, you are mindful. And you have a mindful use of time. You become selective with your time, avoiding time wasting activities. What's that? Eh, kuchano. I'd rather go read a book. I'd rather go do this. I'd rather go do that. I'd rather go do that. I'd rather go do this because this is more fulfilling for me. And it's, I think that if we can have that, then it's going to be great. And then number five is reduced ego and judgment. You care less about what others you care less about what others think, are less judgmental of situations and people. Now, this one is something that we have to even get our katenda for, because, right, many of us are judgmental and many of us ridicule other people's situations so much. And the next one is focus on purpose. You shift from apathy to having a clear sense of purpose and taking action to achieve your goals. So you, in the first place, you set goals. Ahem. So how to notice your own change? By journaling, keeping a daily record. I feel like most of these are a lot of work, and Mina, I don't like this, keeping a lot of work. And also, I have a problem, and I think I've said this many, many times. I have a problem with people stumbling upon my words. Aboo! Stumbling upon the things that I write and then go and read my things. That is why I don't read anybody's things. And also, this is something that came from my friend Bella, like Bella Harris, right? She has always been iffy with her writings. And I never used to care about it. I never used I was always a writer. So I would write. I'd leave my content everywhere. It was like I was leaving droplets everywhere until I met her, and she was keeping every single book so close to her heart as if she was guarding diamonds, right? And then I started to realize, because you know, birds of the feather, you know, later on you must flock together, right? I started to realize that, Mara, do I really also want people to read my things? You know, then I copied it, because I also don't want people to read my things, because I was now writing my things. So for those that want to write, because you live alone and nobody's going to read your stuff, or you have great hiding places, keep a daily record of your experiences and reactions to observe how you respond to situations over time. Number two, self-reflection. Regularly examine your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, noticing differences compared to your past self. So if you used to be an iffy person, if you used to be very, very angry, if you used to be very, very what, then you should go back and look at who you are now, and you can now evaluate whether or not there is a change, there is no change, and if you have gradually moved from the person that you were, the person that you didn't want to be, to the person that you want to be. So that's how we do it, okay? And observe your reactions. Pay attention to how you respond to stresses, conflict, or new opportunities as changes in these reactions indicate growth. So if you were working on your confidence, if you are working on your self-esteem, and new opportunities come because you have been doing the work, you know, to be responsive, to be nice, to be what, and then new opportunities come up and then you're running away, you must look at it, because am I running away because I'm not good, or am I running away because I'm scared? You must look at those things. And especially with stresses, you must observe them nicely, because stresses are the ones that get you into deep trouble. And this deep trouble is the same deep trouble that's going to just drive you wild and take you back to point one. So if you are a person that used to stress a lot, and then now you have worked on it and you have tried to change that, when stressful situations come up, look at how you handle it. And also, avoidance of a stressful situation is also, it's also bad. It's also just not changing, but choosing to not react or running away from it, escaping. Like our previous speaker who that was speaking to us was telling us about escaping, trying to escape their own lives. So review your relationships. Notice if your interactions and relationships are evolving, which can be a sign of personal changes. So if you've decided that you're not going to be a bad person anymore, you're going to be loving, you're going to be a great partner, and now your relationships have moved from we don't talk anything and we talk a lot now, then you can see that, I've changed, because even this is happening. And if you haven't, it gets worse than how you started, and that's how you know, zero progress happening here. And that was all she wrote for this Friday evening. Simply because today we had to see, we had to hear from the world, and keep in mind that we as Eagle Media House do not claim any ownership of any clips or information that we have shared. We are simply using it for illustration purposes, for sharing purposes, for igniting a fire purposes, for being, you know, the baddest in the room kind of vibes. So take it from there. But from me, the matriarch, I bid you guys farewell. I love you forever and a day. And I'm going to sign myself out with a little something that's close to my heart.
Let's go.
Sometimes I feel a little sorry for myself, but it is okay. I bid you guys farewell. I love you forever and a day, and I'll see you tomorrow at 1 p.m.